Coming to you from the Fifth Avenue Manhattan mansion of Tony Stark and the Mighty Avengers, this is the 7th Long Box Graveyard Podcast. I am Paul O'Connor, your host. In the next couple hours, I will bring you up to date on what is happening at my Long Box Graveyard comic book blog, and I'll also bring you this month's feature, which is The Few 52. This will be a slightly longer show than usual, also hopefully more fun, as I have a co-host this month in the form of my old pal, Chris Ulm, who's also a comics fan of long standing, and the former editor-in-chief of Malibu Comics. But I'll get to his full introduction in a moment, after a few words about the podcast and the news. In the last month since I've talked to you, I've been to China and back, which is cool, but not really germane to the podcast, so I won't talk about it. What is important is I've received some feedback recently, which I really appreciate. I won't call anybody out by name, but I have received some email, both about this podcast and about my blog, that was especially heartening to me, helped me go forward and helped me continue these operations. One that touched me especially was from a listener that had listened to the very first Long Box Graveyard podcast, the Childish Things broadcast, and he said that that particular broadcast helped him put some things back in order in his own life following the death of his father. So that helps me a lot. So the reason I do this stuff is to connect with you guys, and also, you know, I explore my own past, but the more I explore my own past, I find that it's a past we all share. So I hope you continue to enjoy the podcast. Please tell your friends about it. And as always, if you have feedback for me, let me know. You can either leave a message at the show site. You can always write me at longboxgraveyard@gmail.com. Of course, you can find me at the blog, which is www.longboxgraveyard.com. So the news. This month, I'm flipping around the news segment. These past few months have proven that my schedule at Longbox Graveyard is so fluid as to resist forecasting a month in advance. What is certain is that I publish a new blog every Wednesday. What's less certain is what I actually publish and in what order. So rather than giving an accurate picture of the month ahead, I will instead give a brief summary of the month just passed. This means this month's news will be a little redundant because I did promise some of these subjects last time around, but I'll keep the descriptions brief, and then when I join you again in January, I can talk about the new old stuff that I haven't covered yet. I know that's clear as mud, but here we go. So here's what happened at Long Box Graveyard since my last podcast. Hopefully you checked out one or more of these blogs, and if you didn't, you can find them all indexed under the Checklists tab at www.longboxgraveyard.com. On the 14th of November, I published a blog on Mordillo's Island, a Master of Kung Fu story. It's the second Master of Kung Fu blog I've published in recent weeks after going almost a year and a half without talking about one of my favorite comics at Longbox Graveyard, the Mordillo's Island series. Maybe a lesser series, but has some things to recommend it. And some terrific Paul Galassi artwork was published on the blog that day. So if you're interested in that, that was on the 14th. On the 21st of October was a panel gallery called Button Men. A bit of a fill-in, but I was out of China. I was out of town. I was in China. So take a look at that. It's just a very, my own strange obsession with comic book villains, mostly pushing buttons and causing terrible things to happen. On the 28th was Superhero Greenlight, Doctor Strange. This is where we pitched concepts, directors, and casting for a theoretical Doctor Strange movie. It was one of the more popular blogs in recent months, sparked a good conversation thread and comments, which I appreciate. Much of the success of that blog is owed to my collaboration with Tom Mason and with Chris Ulm, who's also here today, of course. I hope we can do additional Superhero Greenlight columns in the weeks and months to come. So if you're interested in Doctor Strange or superhero movies, check that out. It was published on the 28th at Longbox Graveyard, Superhero Greenlight, Doctor Strange. On the 5th of December was the Longbox Graveyard Holiday Comic Book Gift Guide, which was my rather pathetic, transparent attempt to drive some click revenue through my site, of which I've received zero, but that's okay. It's also kind of a review of what I've covered here the past year. So if, you know, if you're looking for gifts or you're looking to buy stuff for yourself, check out the site and click on some of my links and buy stuff for yourself, and I'll make nickels, which is always good. Also that day, my Dollar Box review over at Snatch My Comics went live. That was the 7th Dollar Box review. This time it was of Captain Marvel number 34 from 1974. It's a lesser-known Jim Starlin comic, but it had far-reaching repercussions both for the Marvel Universe and for your humble narrator. So please check that one out over at stashmycomics.com. Finally, on December 12th, the week this podcast goes live, at the blog is the winter 2012 edition of my Longbox Soapbox editorial column, hearkening back to the great Stanley soapboxes of the past. In my Longbox Soapbox, I do them once every 6 months at the blog. This is the 18-month anniversary of the blog, so it's the third soapbox I've done. This is a blog about the blog. So I look at numbers and trends behind the blog and the podcast. I state whether I'll continue in the endeavor, and I will. But the numbers and the details are at the blog, so check it out if that kind of thing interests you. And that is the month that was at Longbox Graveyard. The month ahead will bring articles on the importance of Captain Marvel to the Marvel Universe of comics, a review of the 1975 Marvel Treasury Edition Giant Superhero Grab Bag, and more. So if any of these topics spark your interest, please head over to Longbox Graveyard, give it a read, and of course, please share your impressions in my comments section. Okay, that is the news. So let's get to this month's feature, which is The Few 52. As you are doubtless aware, DC Comics, about a year ago, rebooted their entire superhero comic book line in a new format called The New 52, attempt to reinvigorate existing titles, introduce new readers, and especially, I think, reintroduce or reinterest lapsed readers in the DC comic book line. I thought we'd talk about a few of them today. It's The Few 52 because we're not going to review all of them. We're just going to look at, well, it looks like 9 or 10 of the books that have recently been published in trade paperback editions. And there's no real rhyme or reason to the books we're going to take a look at. They're just the ones that I found interesting and bought as I saw them, or those that were interesting to my co-host this month, who is Chris Ulm, who joins us. So help you guys understand Chris a little bit. Let me tell you about Chris. How long have we known each other? About 30 years?
Yeah, it feels like 60.
Yeah, sure does. That's human years, and in dog years it's even longer. So 30 years, the Ulm and I have been palling around. We've been partners in a number of ventures. We worked in a game store together. We were comic book professionals together, most germane to this podcast. We'll talk about that in a second. We also have developed video games together forever. First at Oddworld Inhabitants, right?
Right.
And
High Moon.
And High Moon Studios, right? We're partners at High Moon, where we created Dark Watch. And most recently at Appy Entertainment, our iPhone company, which I don't talk about much on the podcast, but you can look it up if you're interested, www.appyentertainment.com. But more germane, I think, to our conversation is, A, you're a comic book fan. So tell us about when you first got into comics, Mr. Ulm.
Oh, God, I've been into comics as long as I can remember. I used to throw trash can lids at my brother and pretend I was Captain America.
Mm.
And I used to remember when Iron Man had those wacky steam-powered roller skates.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I had those steam-powered roller skates, too, made out of concrete, I think, at the time.
Now, when you started with Iron Man, who was the artist? Was it Gene Colan?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was Gene Colan, and I think it was Gene Colan, yeah.
And he's still your favorite superhero today.
Oh, yeah. Well, Gene Colan could draw a shadowed hand like no other.
Yeah, it's true. And he could also wring emotion out of that iron face. Now, this tells me why you're a fan of Iron Man, because that was a classic era. Now, when I started reading comics, which is only about a year later, I think, when I started reading comics, Iron Man was drawn by George Tuska, and he had a nose.
Oh, well, the nose came later. The nose came way later.
The nose was the summer of 1974.
No.
Yeah, it was.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So,
I'm out.
So, I wasn't that attached to Iron Man, but you can understand these first
The nose was terrible, by the way.
The nose was terrible.
I dropped the book after the nose came out. I was very upset.
And the nose, apparently, this has nothing to do with the New 52, and maybe the rest of the podcast will be like this, but the nose, apparently, as I recall from reading Sean Howe's book, The Untold Story of Marvel, which we both enjoyed, in that, I think there was an anecdote where he said the reason Iron Man had a nose was just like some drive-by art direction from
Stan Lee.
He was just looking at pages and said, shouldn't he have a nose? And then wandered out, and the artist...
He was like drunk at the time or something. That didn't make any sense.
We got to give Iron Man a nose. So they drew one on him for about 6 months until Stan saw it again and said, well, what the hell is this having a nose for? It's the dumbest thing I ever saw in my life.
How did that get in there?
Yeah, which is the kind of story that we would have scoffed at and said, no way does a major corporation run that way, but these past 30 years in our experience...
It's exactly the way it runs.
It's exactly
what happens.
All right, so that's why Iron Man has a nose and why you're a fan of Marvel Comics, but not DC.
But it is germane to this conversation because I pretty much grew up on Marvels, and even at Malibu, Marvel was sort of my watchword, with a few exceptions, which we'll talk about. Mm-hmm. And so this, to me, was really an introduction to a lot of the DC characters, the New 52 was.
Certainly the backbench characters. I mean, everybody knows the big three.
Yeah.
But some of the more obscure characters, which are actually the ones we're going to look at today, I agree. I'm kind of the same way with a lot of these guys. I think I'm a little more familiar with them than you are, but not a lot. Mostly a Marvel guy, as you can tell by reading the blog, but, you know, I like some of the DC characters, too. For me, it's also been kind of, who is this guy? I vaguely know him. And maybe that's worth stating up front as a disclaimer in our reviews to follow, is that well, Chris and I are far from new to comics, unfortunately. We are bringing kind of new perspective to New 52. And except in cases where we'll state it ahead of time, we're not bringing a lot of baggage in terms of our expectations for the characters, past storylines, what creators have done or haven't done. To us, it's all new. So it may be that there's an interpretation of Dead Man or Animal Man here or something that really frosts longtime readers because it just doesn't fit with their expectations. We're largely immune to those.
Yeah.
So let's see. Well, shall we just dive? Before we do that, let's talk a little bit more about your comic book background. So you were a comic book fan for many years, but then later, professionally, you were also...
Yeah, well, I started a comic book company with three other guys, Dave Albrecht, Tom Mason, and Scott Rosenberg, who was the president of a company called Malibu Comics, which had many imprints. I think we figured out that it had 12 imprints at last San Diego Con when we did our retrospective that you kindly hosted. And we did tons and tons of comics, literally tons and tons of comics over the 11 years that the company was around. And we originally, eventually acquired by Marvel Comics.
That's right.
But we came very close. We flirted a lot with DC, came very close to being acquired by DC Comics. Mm-hmm. So we got to know both editorial staffs and both the people, you know, both of the management teams running the companies. And we launched our own line of superhero comics. We launched multiple lines, but the two that most people remember would be Image Comics. Mm-hmm. And then we also launched our own line of superheroes called Ultraverse. So this whole idea of, you know, launching a bunch of comics all at once was something that we did as well.
And you did a podcast with the We Talk Comics guys, I think, about 6 months ago, you and Dave Olbrich, right?
That's right.
Where you talked about a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to plug the WTC special edition where they talked about Malibu quite extensively. Chris was a guest on that show. I was a fly on the wall while they were talking. I remember there's some great stories. So if you're interested in more stories about Malibu Comics, it's rise and fall. Not really its fall. It's rise and gentle decline and then riding off into the sunset through...
Being snapped up.
Yeah, through successful acquisition, which is a rare thing. Please check that out. I'll put it in the show notes as well at the end of the night so you guys can find it if you're interested. But that's looking back. Let's look forward, or at least look at today. Let's talk about the New 52. So in no particular, what we've done for the show is that Chris and I have each read the same stack of trade paperbacks over the last, you know, 3 or 4 weeks. Or actually, we've been doing it for months, but it was only in the last couple of weeks we decided we'd do a show around it. We haven't really talked with each other about which ones we liked or which ones we disliked. So we've taken some notes. We're going to talk about each show or talk about each collection briefly. Then we're going to rate it between 1 and 5 stars, 5 being the best. And then we'll say whether or not, on the basis of what we've read so far, we're interested in buying the next collection. Now, it's possible something may get 5 stars and you don't want to buy the next collection because you just think, you know, I like it, but I don't need more. Or it might be that something gets 1 or 2 stars, but you would buy the next collection because of an affection for the character or you see some promise or positive trends. But we don't know ahead of time who liked what. We'll do a summary at the end of the show with our scores out of 10, because I'll add our scores together. And what we're looking for here is a book that scores 8 stars or higher that we both want to buy the next volume. That would probably be the Longbox Graveyard Seal of Approval. Hopefully, we'll violently disagree on everything, because that makes for good radio.
There'll probably be a lot of anger. At some point, this may just end.
That's right. And we have these kind of pointless arguments all the time at work. We'll see if we can make it happen here at the secret headquarters with Longbox Graveyard. So, let's begin with the book that's arbitrarily on the top of the stack, and one of the more obscure titles of the New 52. This is Justice League Dark, Volume 1, In the Dark, by Peter Milligan and Mikael Janin, or Janin, I'm not sure how to say his name. For those of you unfamiliar, Justice League, and these will be, you know, spoiler-free summaries if you're concerned about those things. The Justice League Dark is the story of the unwilling team-up of many of DC's contemporary supernatural characters, and by extension, characters that neither Chris nor I know that much about. Zatanna, Madame Xanadu, John Constantine, Shade the Changing Man, who is an old Steve Ditko character, Mind Warp.
Dead Man,
who I thought was most memorable in this story. Dead Man seems intent on relieving his sexual frustration with his girlfriend by possessing various men and women and trying to seduce her. That's pretty cool.
I like that part.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah.
Quite a bit.
So the premise seems to be that the team takes on the mystical threats that the costume members of the Justice League cannot handle, but aside from Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, and Cyborg, and a little cameo, there's very little Justice League in the Justice League Dark. My summary, I thought the story was a little bit of a muddle. It concerns Madame Xanadu trying to prevent a dire prophecy from coming true. There's some amnesiac girl at the center of everything. Her fate is somehow bound up with the power of the book's big bad guy. There's some good characterization, Plenty of inter-team conflict as these characters go about trying to solve the problem in different ways. I found the tale jumped around a bit too much for me to follow. I checked out about halfway through, aside from perking up when Deadman came on screen, and pretty much lost interest by the time I got to the end of the volume.
I pretty much largely agree on that one. I thought it was a forgettable story, and partly because I liked some of the individual characters, and I've always been a John Constantine fan. Hmm. But they were, you know, I could really feel the writer's hand moving these chess pieces around. And you know, with a team book, that's almost always the way it goes. It's so hard to deal with eight characters that you have to give screen time to. But you really felt it in this one. It just really felt very plot heavy, and I didn't get a chance to really understand why these people were together and the relationships they had with each other, which all seemed kind of one note.
They were kind of thrown together. Now, it's interesting, I didn't perceive it at the time that I read Justice League Dark, but later on, when reading, which one was it here? I, Vampire, which we'll talk about a little bit later, I could see where that book and this book were connected.
Yeah.
And also looking at some other books we'll talk about today about Swamp Thing and Animal Man, they are obviously connected editorially.
Right.
So it's clear that when they rebooted this New 52, there was some sort of overview or writer's conference or something where they laid down what were the plot lines, at least for the first 6-12 months.
Yeah.
Which made me think about, coincidentally, the way you guys started the Ultraverse, which started off with a writer's conference, and you guys had a Bible. I think the guys probably shredded it and threw it away in the first 2 or 3 months.
Actually, that didn't happen. Oddly enough, people were using that Bible all the way for the first 3 to 4 years.
Well, there you go.
And we were using it pretty extensively. The difference there is that we had one big event, that an ultra event that caused all this stuff to happen, and mm-hmm. then everybody's origin story pretty much started at that one event, whereas what DC's doing, which I think is really interesting, is that some of the continuity they're completely keeping. Because they had this Flashpoint miniseries, which launched the New 52, mm-hmm. they kept some of the, you know, some of the initial, like Batwoman's, all the continuity stays.
Yeah.
Right. But other characters, they completely revamped. So they got to kind of do whatever they wanted to. So that was interesting, but also for a new reader, it's a little bit confusing as to these backstories. So I was just looking for what I would have loved about Justice League Dark if the characters really were coming to the fore, but they were all trying to service the plot. So it didn't come. It didn't work for me as much as it could have.
It did feel a little mechanical. I thought the art was good.
The art was great.
Some characterization, individual characterization. We both like Deadman. That's a character. An example.
I love Deadman.
I don't know him that much. Did you read him back in the day?
A little bit. Yeah, I always liked Deadman when he showed up. He was just kind of a bizarre character, but I liked the new interpretation of him a lot. I thought it was a real up to date interpretation.
Was that a Neil Adams character, Deadman? I seem to think that Neil Adams drew
him. I don't know. I don't remember.
I don't know. So decent characterization. I like the ending. Strangely enough. But now I understand the ending also belongs in iVampire, and I like that book better, so I'm happy to follow that story there. Hot girls, never a bad thing. Lots of females in this particular book.
But they all felt the same to me. One of the problems is that there were like one enchantress after another. There's you know, the Black Orca, the enchantress, Zatanna, mm-hmm. Madame Xanadu. I mean, it's kind of, I didn't really get a sense of what made them different. I'm sure that longtime DC fans know that, but
yeah.
I didn't as somebody coming into this book.
Yeah, Madame Xanadu also shows up in Demon Knights, another book we'll be looking at today. But she was particularly annoying in this book because she just kind of was one of those prophetess types who can't ever tell you what's really going wrong.
Yeah, it's still like empath characters.
Yeah, I'll give you that. So decent ending, Hot Girls, but I think we can both agree maybe less than the sum of its parts.
Yeah, so what's the star rating there?
I'd give it 2 stars, 2 out of 5, and I say I'm not interested in buying the next volume.
So I'd give it 3 stars.
Okay.
I thought the art was really good, and I liked some of the characterization. So I thought 2 was a little too unfair. But how much I liked it was probably 2 stars. Overall, I probably wouldn't pick up the next series.
So we're both thumbs down on Justice League Dark. And I should say that none of the books that I read in this New 52 were truly terrible. There were
all good.
Yeah, there's none that I want to throw across the room. It really is kind of an embarrassment of riches. Even the worst of the books, and I don't know, this might be the worst of them as far as I'm concerned. Maybe not. Even the poorest of the books had high quality, good quality standard. But because we're reading them as collections, we don't have to deal with delays or any rotating creative teams or any nonsense like that.
Yeah, I think DC Editorial really deserves applause for the wide-ranging quality. We were never able to achieve that wide-ranging quality. That's really tough to do, and they did a great job. I also point out that... for John Constantine and Shade, they haven't been in the regular DC universe for 20 years.
They haven't.
So this is the first time that they've been, you know, through the New 52, been brought into the non-Vertigo regular DC universe.
Huh. Well, so, I knew that Constantine was a Vertigo character, of course, although famously
Well, he went to Vertigo. I think it was actually predated Vertigo.
His book was just canceled. Did you know that? Constantine was canceled after 300 issues.
Yeah.
I'm walking around because I'm getting a beer here for the listeners at home. So, yeah, I mean, the show, the regular Constantine, or, you know, Hellblazer book has been canceled and it's being restarted as a New 52.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess and also Wildstorm books are also being folded into the New 52.
Yeah,
basically what they're doing is they're canceling all the DC is becoming one big universe with multiple facets rather than micro universes.
So we're saying that with Swamp Thing and Constantine coming into the New 52 and Karen Berger departing DC Comics, that we think the writing's on the wall for Vertigo as an independent imprint. Is that what you're saying, Mr. Rome? Did we hear it here first?
I think so. I think it's clear that now is a time for consolidation, and then they'll blow it all up in 5 or 6 years and change it again, but right now is a time for consolidation, it seems like.
So in your background as a publisher, what's the value of having different imprints? So you said you had a dozen of them at Malibu, but mostly that was you just like staying one step ahead of the law, right?
Well, for us, the value was you'd pick the imprint that was selling the most units, unfortunately. I think for companies that have better capitalization, you might actually have one, you know, to try to service different demographics, service different customers. So, you know, famously, you'd have a child, one aimed at children. You'd have one aimed at girls. You'd have one aimed at superhero fans. But more and more, I think, with the focus of both Marvel and DC is on core comic fans. So I think it's become less and less desirable to have multiple imprints.
Yeah, and aside from Wildstorm, I guess none of them were really legacy imprints. At Malibu, you guys absorbed a lot of imprints. Eternity was an outside company.
Yeah, Adventure was an outside company. Right. Aircell was an outside company. Yeah. But it doesn't really make much sense anymore because the brands are the characters, not necessarily the books.
But Vertigo, I think, very clearly had a brand identity, but that was a brand identity that was dependent upon Constantine, Sandman, Swamp Thing.
Also, it had different relations with creators, and maybe on a contractual basis. I have no idea about this. Maybe on a contractual basis, it was time to unify how the books were being actually created. Where the copyrights lay and how digital comics are part of that and everything else.
Well, since we're talking about Vertigo, the once and future Vertigo, let's talk about Swamp Thing, our next book here in the Few 52. Swamp Thing, Volume 1, Raise Them Bones by Scott Snyder, Yannick Paquette, and Marco Rudy. So let's see. Here's my notes. Calling this particular volume Swamp Thing, I thought was a bit of a misnomer because there isn't a lot of Swamp Thing in the Swamp Thing. It's instead the story of
Alec Holland.
It really is. Alec Holland fighting botanist.
Well, that sounds good. I think you should write that book. That's a good book.
I've just destroyed the brand.
I want to publish it now.
World's Meanest Botanist. Story of Alec Holland, the once and future Swamp Thing, recast here as a botanist, haunted by his dreams and his swampy past. Destined to become a champion of the green, the great life force of the planet that forever battles the red, the meat force, and the rot, the force of death. That was pretty cool.
I like the rot.
This tale sees Alec Holland trying to resist his fate, but quickly getting swept up in an adventure where he's attacked by creepy, possessed humans who stagger around with their heads cracked around backwards. Pretty soon, Alec is on the road with Abigail Arcane, a femme fatale, and Swamp Thing's old lover, leading to battles with a lot of disgusting monsters and a lot of Alec being tortured as he tries to resist his destiny. What did you think about Swamp Thing, Mr. Owen?
I liked it. I thought, I liked it and I didn't like it. I'll tell you why I liked it. I liked it because it did what the job for the New 52 was. I think it reestablished Swamp Thing in a way that your average reader could understand that didn't know Swamp Thing before. Mm-hmm. And I thought that probably making Alec Holland a human again probably made perfect sense for launching it so that it didn't become completely indecipherable for somebody who wasn't part of it. So I'd give the DC editorial super high marks for the book, but I wouldn't buy it.
Oh, it's
I'm not gonna follow up. And the reason is because this is the one DC book that I was already a fan of.
Aha, yes. Yes. Now we get to the root of it.
So this isn't fair to DC because they did the right thing. But at the end of the day, I don't want a reboot of a reboot, or in this case, a reimagination of a reimagination.
Mm-hmm.
Because I loved the Alan Moore reimagination where they made Swamp Thing into an elemental force. And he thought he was a human being, but he was actually a plant.
Yes, I just love
that. And then making him back into a human, okay, I get why they did it. But personally, I'm not on board with going forward with it, even though I thought it was a really good book.
Yeah, and even and I revere those Alan Moore books too. I think they may be the finest comics, mainstream comics ever published.
They're my top three of all time. They're just brilliantly done.
Absolutely love them. So they do poison me in this regard. And even, you know, going further back, I'm sure you have affection for the Len Wein, Bernie Wrightson version of the character.
Less so, but yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, this character maybe has an embarrassment of riches, and it's had so many good interpretations. And I feel the same way. I love that Alan Moore run so much that it's difficult for me to accept this one. I suspect, like me, you probably haven't read a Swamp Thing comic since Moore left the book in the 80s.
No, this, I actually kept putting this one in the bottom of the stack. I didn't want to read it because of that.
Yeah.
But when I read it, I actually thought it was really good. I thought that they did the team did the best job possible. So this is really my prejudice, not the book. The book is really, really good.
You know, and I know that it was a prejudice because you bought this. You actually bought this one. And I
did.
And
I
you bought it.
I paid for it. I went down to the store and actually paid for that.
You paid for it because the mousy girl cheap. Behind the counter at the comic shop made goo goo guys at you and recommended it.
Yes, she did.
You wanted to impress her.
That finally broke down my resistance. Well, I'm going to have to get a couple of these books. I'm going to get the Swamp Thing one for sure.
Yeah, and I was happy to borrow it too because I do like Swamp Thing. But what I found when I read this that... I want to go back and reread the Alan Moore series.
Yeah. that's classic comics, right? Even Alan Moore hasn't topped that.
Yeah.
That's just a great run of just pure imagination, I thought.
Yeah, and, you know, my subtitle here at Longbox Graveyard is I'm Stuck in 1978. So by my standards, Swamp Thing's this futuristic book, right? Because Alan Moore was writing it in 1985 or whatever. But we were talking about this the other day. What do you do if you're a publisher? DC owns Swamp Thing. I don't think there's any great fight over the copyright on this particular title. It's a character. They want to exploit it. They want to publish comics.
You do what they did, which is the right thing to do. Because at the end of the day, the Alan Moore interpretation, like a lot of Alan Moore stuff, in my opinion, is great for comics. Mm-hmm. Like Watchmen is great because it's taking all the aspects of comics that are so unique to comics, like having a long backstory.
Yeah,
and then folding all those carefully crafted details into a new interpretation, which Alan Moore does great. But you know what? Nobody cares about that for a TV show. And if they're going to relaunch this, all these things to me are like trial balloons for new TV shows.
Yeah,
and I think that they did what they needed to do.
So as much as we kind of bounce off the side of Swamp Thing, some things here we did like. We like the rot. We like the red. We like the green.
Yep.
We especially like the rot.
And that shows up in Animal Man as well.
Yeah, which we'll get to in a second. So I mean, it was imaginative, well illustrated.
It's a good book. If you should, even if you are a fan of the Alan Moore stuff, you should still pick it up. I'm just not finding myself necessarily wanting to go forward with it.
I think I agree with that. And I mean, it's respectful of the prior. It's not like it tramples upon what's gone before.
No. And it does a good job of mixing sort of superheroics with a horror storyline, which is not easy to do either.
Right.
The creators deserve a lot of credit, and DC deserves a lot of credit for Swamp Thing.
Our problem here is not with the book, it's the problem with the reader.
It's with ourselves, as usual.
Yeah, as usual.
As usual.
We're destiny.
Yeah.
All right, so let's give this one a rating. How many stars you give it? And you've already said you wouldn't buy the next one.
I give it 4 or 4.5.
Wow, okay.
I think it's a really good book. And then, how much I liked it, I'd still give it a 3.5. I just won't be buying the next one probably.
Okay, well, you can't give me 2 scores, and you can't use half scores either.
All right.
Give me a score.
I'm going to give it 4.
You give it a 4.
I'll give it 4.
And 4, but no buy.
But no buy for prejudicial reasons.
Okay. And I am the Russian judge. I actually give it 2 and no buy. But,
Wow, 2 is pretty unfair.
Well, I got to admit.
2 is pretty unfair. I can see you not buying it, but come on, 2 is... Should I leave now? Because this is the way it's going to be for the rest of this podcast.
You're welcome to leave now. It'll go faster. No.
Come on.
I'm grading on the curve.
What are you talking about? If you're grading on the curve, you should give it higher.
No, because there are some books coming up that I give 4s and 5s, and you got to balance those off with 2s and 3s.
I still give it a 4. I think even compared to the other books, there's no book that is twice as good as Swamp Thing in this pile. There is no book that's twice as good.
Ooh.
And if you say there's a book that's twice as good, you're wrong.
You will fight me, huh?
Yeah, you're wrong. You're wrong.
Well, I see.
You should at least give it 3 stars.
2, 3.
I want to argue with you that you should at least give it 1 more 4 star, because I think that you're saying that one of these books is twice as good.
I've got 4 books here that are twice as good. I have 4.5 books here that are twice as good.
No.
Because I tell you what, and again, maybe it's a problem. It's my problem. I can see maybe it should be a 3. 2 might be.
It should be 3. It should
be
3.
Might be kind of harsh.
I'm not saying give it a 4, but give it a 3.
I also checked out during portions in here where it's not. It's no longer a comic book story. You know, where there's like some long, expository, gigantic, balloon-flooded pages of characters standing around and describing backstory.
Well, you got to find out about the green and the red.
I really don't. You know,
I wanted to know.
Don't. Well, then show me. Don't tell me. And it does for the most part. When the kid goes in here and wipes out the malt shop, that's pretty groovy.
Yeah,
and
yeah. I think the kid coming in when he's wearing the mask, oxygen mask. Come on, it's 3 stars. You got to give it 3 stars.
And you know, Abigail O'Kane's kind of cool. And all right, I'll go as high as 3, but
yeah, 3 stars is
fair. It's with reluctance. All right, you're talking to a 3, but sure as hell ain't 4.
I still give it a 4.
Are you going to 6 for some of these books? You only got one place to go up.
There's some of the books that I know that you're going to like because they've got, you know, your peccadillos are in them. So,
well, yeah,
but they're not 4 stars.
All right. Well, that's good. Let's move on, and we can continue to tell us how wrong you are about things. So, the next book is Animal Man.
Mm-hmm.
Animal Man, Volume 1, The Hunt. All I knew about Animal Man before picking this volume up were the interstitial cartoons that showed on the late lamented DC animation block on Cartoon Network. So I was way off track in terms of what this guy's about. The book is by Jeff Lemire, don't know which, and Travel Foreman. It's the story of Buddy Baker, superhero and activist, a kind of aging Gen X superhero with a wife and kids and a home in suburban San Diego. Boy, that's cutting kind of close to home. He can channel the power of animals and is cast as the defender of the red, which puts him on a collision course to Swamp Thing, who defends the green. This collection sees Buddy caught up in a bind when his daughter manifests eerie powers of her own, and there follows battles against rot monsters even more disgusting than what was on offer in Swamp Thing.
Yes.
What did you think of Animal Man, Mr. Roman?
Well, my nutshell, I have a little thing that says nutshell, right? And for me, my nutshell was Ulm approved.
Ulm approved.
Ulm approved. I had the stamp this one. This one was, the creative team did a fantastic job. I liked that it was a true family story. I liked the relationship with his daughter, Maxine.
Yes, that was the best part of
it. I thought that was the center of the entire thing.
It was a strong center, and we don't see a lot of that.
It had a strong center. It had strong character relationships, and it had a really strong villain and an epic villain, I thought.
Who's the villain? I don't remember.
It's the Rot.
Well, the Rot. That's like saying the villain.
No, the Rot. I thought it was great. I thought it's
a personality, though. It's not personified.
It has a personality. Really. Yes, it does.
No,
it has,
you're just vulnerable to undead.
No, it's not true. It has a dialogue. It has personality. It definitely has a personality. It almost has it has kind of an evil sense of humor about it. It's disgusting. I love the villain. I thought it was great. I love the way it was told. I thought the interview and the movie sequence that it had within that kind of counterpointed the story, I thought were really good.
You like the movie sequence? That's where I bailed out. The movie sequence.
I thought it was good.
I was on board. I was like on the fence, and then I got to the movie sequence, and I thought, why is this is like 8 pages or 12 pages of why is this here?
I liked it because it's counterpointing the rest of the story, and his son's watching that. I thought it was really good. I thought this one felt like it could easily be a TV series.
Well, I'll give you that, but I'm going to put you on the spot, and how does this long-winded television sequence counterpoint the rest of the series? I get that his son's watching it on his iPod in the back seat or whatever, but mm-hmm. you could show that in just a couple panels.
Necessarily have to be as long as it was. Yeah. I love the fact that they're mixing different approaches to try to tell different facets of the character.
Okay.
And the character that they're hitting on is Buddy, who's Animal Man.
Right.
Who I didn't really know. And what they did, what I'm a sucker for in these books, especially if I don't know the character, is them making that character come to life in a believable way as opposed to just punching, you know, a monster.
Yeah.
Which a lot of, some of the books, which I'm going to disagree with you about, I think violently, are all, that's all it does. That's right. All, it's one punching sequence after another, right? I love this one because the characters felt like they were human characters. And they spent the time, the creative team spent the time to make them into human characters, despite the fantastic elements of the story.
I don't disagree with any of that. And I don't give this a bad book. I don't give this a bad...
Yeah, I think I highly recommend the Animal Man. I think it's really a really good one. And I'm not coming from being a fan of the old Animal Mans at all. Didn't really know very much about them.
It's worth bringing that up because this may be an area where the problem we had with Alan Moore's shadow cast over Swamp Thing, many readers may have trouble with Grant Morrison's shadow cast over Animal Man. Now, I never read the Grant Morrison take. I'm neither here. I have no special affection for Morrison. It's neither here nor there with me, but I could see where that would be something that may interfere with, I don't know to what degree it invalidates or supports Morrison's work on the book, but that may be something that people come away from it. I thought that, I did like the characters. I thought his suburban issues were refreshing. The character's power is not that fascinating to me, but, you know,
yeah.
It depends on how it's handled. Bad guys were great. I mean, I like the bad guys themselves, but I disagree that there's an opponent. To me, this is like a man versus nature story, no pun. right?
This but nature's personified.
But it isn't, because Moby Dick isn't in this, all right? So if you take the whale out of Moby Dick, maybe you have Animal Man.
Well, the whale couldn't talk in Moby Dick, but these guys can talk. So I think they're definitely in there. You're just wrong on this.
They just
one.
Moan. They you just might, say well, brains.
No,
and
they
stuff.
Don't. They don't say brains. They have dialogue.
Do they? I don't remember.
They have dialogue all the way through it.
Yeah. I don't remember, so it must not have been very good.
It was very good.
Okay,
it was very good.
Take your word.
Yeah.
And the artist.
Moby Dick is a character. The Rot's a character. Yeah, it is.
I'm not sure I'm going there.
You're just wrong.
It has a talking cat.
Talking cat's great.
Okay, what's his name? Socks or something?
And you know, the kid reanimates dead things. Of course, I'm going to be all over that.
Yeah. Well, the relationship between Buddy and his daughter
is great.
Yeah, and that gives believable stakes to what could otherwise be a pretty goofy.
I think this team did a great job, and I'm going to smack the writer on another book coming up. So I think he did a fantastic job on this. I think it's really good.
The same writer on a later book. Oh yeah. Well, it's going to be on.
It's
here
coming,
in a second, isn't it?
It's coming.
Okay.
Great story.
I'm looking at my notes now. The other reason I objected to the interlude, the long-winded sort of television interlude here at the back end of the volume, and this is...
Wow, you really didn't like it, did you?
Well,
it's
funny
that I liked it and you didn't.
Well, that's why I'm jumping on
it. It's weird that you're so wrong.
But that's when I got off. That's when I got off the bus. I thought that the story was just getting started by the time we got to the end of this volume. Now, some of that, I mean, it's not the volume's fault. It's just the production, the way they do it, right? Although, I think maybe it's unwise for any comic to do 5 or 6 issues of
Prelude. I grant you, it was a little bit long.
Yeah.
It was longer than you. I just love the fact they're mixing stuff up.
Yeah. And if we'd read this book on a monthly basis, maybe we wouldn't have gotten as deep into it as it is, because some of these, you know, they meander a little bit. You know, they take their time. But as a single sitting, kind of a long read, it works. But I was just thinking, okay, our chess pieces are deployed. I understand the girl's problem. I sort of understand the bad guys. I'm on board with my hero. Let's, you know, give me something to bring this volume to a close and make me want to buy the next one. And instead, it, you know, turns into a CW pilot for 12 pages and then ends. I just didn't float my boat. So let's.
It didn't have a good enough climax. It's anticlimactic for you.
That's
really
part of it.
That's really what it would.
That's part of it. And again, maybe that's not fair because we're looking
I
at.
Think, I think that is a fair. That's a fair criticism of the story. But I still would want to read more.
Yeah.
I'd want to buy the next. I want to buy the next Animal Man.
So you're on board for the next one. How many
stars? It's a 4-star. This one's a 4-star.
4-star for you. I gave it 3. I can tell that we're going to be maybe just 1-star apart on most of this stuff. I liked it. I chose not to buy the next one just because I didn't like the way it came to a conclusion. But if you buy the next one, I'll read it if you throw it on my desk.
Yeah, I think it's definitely worth buying the next one.
Okay. Animal Man. So I give it 3 stars. You give it 4. You get a 4 stars in a buy, and I'm 3 stars in a no buy. But it's not... It's a good book. Like
it's
all
a good
books.
Book. It's not a bad book.
I'm not spiking it. Okay, so now I think it's time for the rumbles. We're going to talk about Frankenstein, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., Volume 1, War
Same
of
writer.
The Monsters. Jeff
Same
Lemire.
Writer.
Alberto Ponticelli is the illustrator. Now, I know, because we talked a little bit out of school, I know you didn't like this book. And the market agrees. As we sit here, Frankenstein's already been canceled. It only ran about 16 issues. The first 7 or 8 of them are collected here, I think. So this may be the only Frankenstein we get. Maybe I think there'll be another collection published in the spring, and then it's done. My nutshell, as I say, it's a goofy action-packed book where Frankenstein's monster, yes, the actual literary Frankenstein's monster, he's the hard-bitten leader of a not-so-undercover monster squad that battles other horrible monsters threatening our world. Not much more to say about it than that. Why don't you go ahead and tell me why you hated this book so much?
Well, first I'll throw out some notes, which is that DC had this character a couple times, and it had been revamped by Grant Morrison.
Right, it was Creature Commandos, right?
Yeah, and it had been revamped by Grant Morrison, and it was originally created with Bob Kane. Edmund Hamilton and Bob Kane created the first version of Frankenstein, which was a mashup between Shelley's version and the Universal Movie Monster.
Okay.
So it was one of those, you know, kind of, let's just put these two things together, and then we don't have to. We can hold on to the copyright.
Right.
That's what it feels like.
Yeah.
And then the fact they added all the other Universal movie monsters in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got your werewolf guy, you got your vampire guy.
So, well, my notes are away. My nutshell is way, way too much of a good thing in this one. You know, I don't think it's not a terrible, like all the DC books that we're talking about here, I don't think there's a single one that is terrible or not worth at least checking out and reading, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
For me, though, on this one, this is a favorite sandwich. You know the favorite sandwich, right? We've talked about this a lot.
But you need to tell it to our
readers. So at Oddworld and other places that Paul and I have worked together, you know, one of the people that we worked with, an artist, brought up this concept of a favorite sandwich. And a favorite sandwich is one that has all your favorite things. So you like marshmallows, you like peanut butter, you like salami, you like mayonnaise, you like mustard, you know, you like horseradish. You put it all in one thing, and of course it's an inedible mess.
Sounds good to me.
And to me, Frankenstein Agent of Shade is a complete favorite sandwich. It's got, you know, it's got a, you know, a crazy collection of characters that make no sense. It's got a storyline that makes no sense. It's got monsters on every page. It's got nothing but, you know, bombastic shouting and killing. There's nothing at all that's even remotely believable about this book. Now, I know we're talking about comics.
Yeah.
Right? And comics can be unbelievable, but the whole point of a great comic is that at its root, you want to believe in it, or that you can suspend your disbelief enough to let it go. And by the fourth page of this one, by the time I get to, you know, Frankenstein's boss and the new...
Frankenstein's boss is great.
The mummy character. The
mummy's,
you know,
great, and they're floating around.
The wolf guy, the vampire guy.
And the atom is in it, and he shrinks them down into this little pocket-sized helicarrier. Yeah, I mean, it's awesome. It's cool.
It's got way too many ideas that are not working together at all. It's nonstop, you know. So I think it does have energy. The book has a lot of energy, and it's bombastic.
Yeah.
And I can see how, if you just want to riff on the energy, it's like a sugar high all the way through, that you can like it for that. And so I don't hold it against anyone but maybe you for doing that. But I think it's not a quality book. It's not a quality story. And it deserved to die in the marketplace.
Oh, that's a little harsh.
It's not satisfying. There's nothing about this book ultimately that's satisfying.
What about when Frankenstein's arm gets ripped off? That's pretty satisfying.
Yeah, I know.
And then he criticizes the doctor while they're stitching it back on.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's some good moments in it, and it does have a lot of energy, but it's not satisfying. It's not a satisfying book.
Wow, it just didn't... I, you know, everything he described as a criticism, I would regard a virtue. Because I agree the book is goofy in a bunch of parts that don't fit, but I think it shoots the moon for goofy.
Yeah.
I think that...
shoot the moon. That's true.
If you took your foot off the gas at all, then this would be a disaster. But instead it goes so fast that it leaps right over the gulf of incredulity and into some marvelous space where it's just a funny, gonzo, flat-out...
See, no, I disagree.
Goofball, enjoyable romp.
I think it goes right off and the engine explodes. It's just, you know, by halfway through, you're going, okay, when is this going to be over? It's just too much. It's like, you know what this is? This is the equivalent of Battleship, you know, that movie that just came out, right? Just nonstop.
That's right.
It's just nonstop violence and stupidity. Just, you know, enough. It's just not, you got to have some meat there. You got to have something there, right? You got to have something that doesn't have anything there. There's no there.
There was there. There's a marital conflict at the center of it. Between,
there is not.
Yes, there is.
It's an ex-wife that's got four arms.
That's
Come on.
Right.
None of it makes any sense.
Well, I agree it makes no sense that no man would divorce a woman that had four
arms. No, I certainly wouldn't. It's not terrible.
Yeah.
Again, it's just... I'm not going to want to read the next one. By the way, I can't because the audience rejected it.
Yeah. So, well, I think there will be one more volume of it. Now, I will say also, I thought the last issue, or the last story in here, I don't know which one it was, the Rise of the Humanids looked like the last one they started here. I don't know if they changed inkers or art process.
That story was also a little more interesting to me.
See, this is where I was waiting to get off here because something happened. It lost some of the grit, just the visual grit, and I don't see it in the creator notes. But that art and that art, to me, are very different.
Coloring is changing.
Yeah, is that what it is?
Some other stuff might be changing, too.
Something's going on. Well, I'm sorry I'm not going to see more of these characters, get to know them. I like the kind of, I like the amoral mad scientist leaders of the group. It was like being plunged into Portal or Half-Life 3 kind of world. I like the characters. I have a weakness, of course, for the Universal Monster, so I totally accept those archetypes.
But they're terrible versions of those archetypes. There's nothing creepy or monstrous about them. They're just all hyper-science.
That's what's fun. There's nothing creepy or monstrous about those guys now.
You know, it's like, you know what it's like? It's like Sharktopus. It's just two things that aren't going together. It's a favorite sandwich. I'm out.
So now I'm going to say something that's really going to enrage you. Really going to enrage you.
Good.
Because when I read this book, I thought... Now, the other thing I'll admit is this was the first of the new 52 books I read. It was a couple months ago. Maybe I was drunk. Maybe I was high when I read it. I don't know, right?
I doubt that.
Well, that's true. But I haven't reread it since. And I should reread it to see if I over, you know, like when I, like Ang Lee's Hulk, right? I saw the Hulk.
Yeah, I told you that was terrible.
I thought it was, I came out thinking it was great, and I've seen it a couple times since then, not so great. So it could be that I was just in one of those moods where first blush, I didn't like it very much, or I liked it too much. But here's the other thing, very specific connection for you and I, and this will make you angry.
It doesn't enrage me so far.
It will, because when I read Frankenstein, Agent of Shade, I thought we could have written this comic, you and I, and we would have called it Dark Watch. That's what I thought it would have been. So
I actually agree, which is part of my problem.
That's maybe it's, so it's self-loathing. That's why.
No, it's not self-loathing. It's that I, as a creator, I want to provoke something that has higher quality than that.
Okay.
You can do that. You can pull that off at the end. I mean, Iron Man 1, the movie, pulls that off, right?
Sure.
It's got gonzo action in it, but it also has a heart. And no. So my weakness as a creator is that my characters generally, my books don't generally have the level of heart I like to see.
This book has a heart, too. I see this one. There's several hearts on this page.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
Crap's getting ripped out of them. All right, so for benefit of our listeners who don't have an encyclopedic knowledge of the various failed creative initiatives of you and I. Not only is the failure is unfair.
Yeah.
But we made a game. Coming. We made a game in, what was it, 2005, I think is when it came out, mm-hmm. called Dark Watch. It was a video game. You and I, Chris, along with our partners, Emmanuel Valdez and Farzad Velaramian, were the co-creators of this original property, which was a vampire western, a first-person shooter on, PlayStation and Xbox, right?
Yep.
And the premise was we followed the story of this half-vampire Jericho Cross cursed gunfighter who was doomed to wander the world until the last vampire was slain or something. Right. I forget what our backstory
was. No, that's exactly right. He was an anti-hero.
Yeah.
Very much, you know, anti-heroes are always tough.
Right, but
there is one of these books that does pull that off.
Yeah,
we're going to get to it.
We'll get to that. But what worked here is that the other thing about Dark Watch, and Dark Watch was a favorite sandwich, to be fair,
yeah.
right? The other thing about Dark Watch is the reason it was called Dark Watch is Dark Watch was the secret society in the Old West. Our original pitch was Men in Black meets something in the... I can't remember. It was Men in Black in the Old West, right? So it was a Men in Black style secret society, sort of a steampunk, high tech for its age, mm-hmm. vampire fighting operation that could easily be Shade here, right? And our hero.
But even Dark Watch was much more consistent, had less ideas at the heart of it, less characters at the heart of it than this one does. This is also folding in, you know, high tech, micro stuff, you know, old characters,
yeah.
Universal movie monsters that are all reimagined, you know, robots. basically, it's got everything in it that you can imagine in this thing. Whereas Dark Watch really was, it had monsters, it had vampires, and it had the Old West. That was the thing.
Yeah. Right. But I thought, you and I also, we grappled, we tried to make a Dark Watch comic book. We made one. We wrote one for Heavy Metal. It was...
We didn't try. We made it. It's
yeah.
published, and it's out there, and I thought that actually is pretty good.
Yeah, but we had to aim away from the heart of Dark Watch for a couple of reasons. One was a production reason, because it ended up being a prequel, because
yeah.
we need more women in it, because if you don't have women on the cover of Heavy Metal, it doesn't sell worth a darn.
That's
so
right.
we concentrated on our supporting characters. But we were never really able to come to grips with the nature of our hero and how he related to his crazy organization and how all this... pieces
right.
fit together. And part of that was just because it was a first-person shooter video game and it's difficult to sustain a narrative in that environment. It's not possible. Obviously, it's been done and done well with games like Halo and Half-Life. But it was difficult for us, at least. We had a lot of ideas we were trying to get in there at once. And when I read this, I thought this had some of the energy and the attitude that
mm-hmm.
would have benefited Dark Watch, which tended to be kind of a dour, sort of serious approach.
Right.
I found that refreshing in Frankenstein.
I don't hate that. I mean, like I said, I think the energy is the thing that it has going for it. I mean, I gave it, so here's, this will enrage you, I gave it 3 stars, but I gave it only 1 star for myself, so I'm going to only give it 2 stars as a result.
How many people are sitting across the desk from me?
I'm just telling you, I thought, well, because I think it's a competently done book. It's a very well done book. The writer and the creative team are good, and they're taking a legacy character that already is goofy with
yeah.
all sorts of stuff, and they're trying to make it relevant, and they took a stab, you know, they took a shot. It just doesn't work for me.
So you're 2 stars, no buy.
Two stars, no buy.
Yeah, I think. Well, I only give it 3. I mean, as much as I like it, because I grade on the curve, because I'm not, you know, I'm not just I love or hate it. I don't have a knob with two dials on it that says sucks or awesome.
If you like it, you should give it 4 stars.
I don't like it that much.
Yeah. See,
I like to argue about it. I'm not even sure I'd buy the next one, and that's because I from the last story here, it appears that the quality's declining. I also know it's going to be canceled, so it's a little difficult to maybe make a further investment in.
So you're a fair weather friend, is what I'm hearing.
Hell yeah! I mean, we live in an era of geek plenty. There's no reason to go down with the ship on any of these books. Okay.
Go down with the ship seems a little hard.
All right. Well, it's not our responsibility to be in love with these guys. I mean, they put a story in front of us. We like it or we don't. But they rotate creator teams and they cancel books all the time. So I don't feel that – I don't have that collector's mentality where I have to have the next volume.
No, either do I.
Just because I like this one. But, you know, I'll thumb through it in the store and maybe I'll – you know, maybe I'll get it for your birthday. It'll be out in the spring.
If I got it for free, I'd read the next installment.
All right. Well, that's Frankenstein, Agent of Shade, about which the Ulm is incorrect. So the next one is Batwoman, Volume 1, Hydrology.
By the way, terrible subtitle.
Yeah, it's not good.
Please do not name your story Hydrology.
It's if not you're, a good one. Well, maybe if you're a plumber, right? You know,
Mario.
There was that video game, Siphon Filter. Remember that? Always felt like a part for my hot tub.
Yeah, it's a terrible name.
Yeah, so Hydrology is not great. Now, the previous volume in the non-New 52 version was Elegy. That was a pretty good title.
Yeah.
But now Hydrology, I know why, but I agree, it's not a good one. This is by J.H. Williams III and W. Hayden Blackman.
Boy, and not really a relaunch, right? They kept most of the continuity that was going on with Batwoman. So this one is not a relaunch.
That's what my notes here. It says, one of the more opaque of these few 52. I don't see how this qualifies for a reboot. Picks up directly from the new pre-52 Adventures of Batwoman, which is no problem for me because I'm a big fan of Batwoman and I like the Elegy trade paperback. I think new readers may be lost here.
Yeah.
The volume follows the adventures of Batwoman, one of Gotham's newest crime fighters, who operates outside the law, even as she fights for justice. She's still making up her mind about herself, and Gotham is doing the same thing. Even Batman hasn't decided if Batwoman can be trusted just yet. In this volume, Batwoman is on the trail of a water witch that drowns her child victims. It's all very mysterious and moody and noirish. There's also superhero fist fights. There's a sidekick subplot. I'll tip my hand a little bit. I'm a fan. I'm maybe a little indifferent to this particular volume, but I'm a fan of the character. Tell me what you think about Batwoman.
Well, what I think is fascinating is that the original Batwoman was created by Bob Kane and Sheldon Moldoff.
Yeah, back in the day, she was kind of a truck driver woman,
well,
right?
No, with writer Edmund Hamilton. The character was introduced as a love interest.
Oh, that's right, because
to disprove allegations of homosexuality for Batman.
She was
a fag. I love. That was 1954.
So the original Batwoman was a fag hag, is what you're saying, right?
Well, the original Batwoman was to make sure that everyone realized that Batman, despite having a Dick Grayson as a ward,
that's true,
was not homosexual. And now, of course, in this one, she's a lesbian.
Right.
Right? The revamp prior to the New 52. I thought it was kind of cold. The book felt kind of cold to me, just in general.
Yeah. A lot of that's
it kind of still feels like a book also that's designed to get PR for DC as being an inclusive company that's doing a lesbian character.
I don't expect it sells very well.
Well, my problem is that I just didn't connect with the characters in the book as much as I was hoping to. You know, I didn't necessarily like her as a character, and just for whatever reason, I just didn't connect to what was going on in the storyline as much. Now, I might have liked the earlier story, Elegy, more than this one.
Yeah, I did too.
But I'd have to say, so again, I think it's a high quality book. I think that editorial at DC deserves credit for reaching and for doing different kinds of stories and different kinds of characters, but I just, for whatever reason, this one didn't connect.
There is a remote quality of the art. It's even in terms
it's like
of
that
page
80s. Who was that 80s artist that always kind of did that very cold blue kind of women that are like hanging everywhere? There was Nagel or something like that. You know what I'm talking about?
Ring a bell.
Anyway, yeah. You see him all the time in 80s kinds of movies.
I mean, it's rendered to a very high technical skill. And the page layouts are inventive to the point of being distractible or distraction at points. In a sense, it has it evokes a feeling of stained glass, right?
Yeah.
And in that sense, it's almost as remote as looking at things in a church sometimes. But boy, can you imagine if there was anyone that could draw to this level of ability when we were starting comics?
Oh my God!
Right, like the closest guy back in the day in the 70s would have been a Neil Adams or somebody. But this is, you know. This is fine art.
It's very. I mean, the art is beautiful.
It's very polished.
It's very polished.
Yeah,
and the story is well written too. It's just, I think for whatever reason, it's not really working. This particular character and this particular story is not really working for me. So I'd give it 3 stars total.
Yeah, I think how many I gave it. I have to look it up here. I actually give it 3 stars as well. See what my notes here say. So the art's beautiful. Sometimes sacrifices storytelling for style. Now, Kate Kane, despite her origins as, you know, her crazy Silver Age origins, she's one of my favorite new characters in comics. And now, in a sense, I'm going off script here because I'm reviewing Elegy, the prior volume, rather than what we have here.
Right.
But it's important to understand. You have to read that to understand what the character's about. And that's why I think maybe this volume is a little less successful, especially as part of a rolling reboot of a New 52. There's a place for new readers to come on board because you don't really get anything of what she's about. The character, you know, her sense of duty is forged in the military, then transferred to costume crime fighting because she's forced out of the military because of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And that ties in with her sexuality. And
that was all an elegy, right?
Yeah, and that makes her sexuality central to the character, but doesn't
I didn't get that from not reading the earlier story.
It's not here. So the earlier story is about how she wants to follow in her father's footsteps.
See, I would have liked that.
Be a woman of honor. And you've actually read Elegy. You just don't remember because I loaned it to you, right? So it didn't make a great impression.
I just don't remember.
I'll send it home with you if you like. So, you know, her honor requires that she's put on the spot. Her superior officer says, look, I'll look the other way if you just want to just say that this was a mistake and you're never going to see this woman again. And she cites the honor code, which says a cadet can't lie. So, no, it's true, sir.
Right.
You know, and then she gets thrown out of the military. So she trans... So that pushes... She still wants to serve, right? She still wants to... She has a sense of service and need to help, and that's what drives her into being a superhero. But that puts her sexuality at the center of the character, but it's not salacious or exploitative, which I think is a real hat trick or amazing for a comic.
Very, book, right? Very difficult to do in comics.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to see a mainstream superhero comic handle a lesbian hero better than they handle Kate.
That's true. Even this book handles that better than any yeah. mainstream superhero comic.
Because they don't angle away from it, but it's, you know, it's not the way I would have written it in X-Mutants. let's just leave it at that. Also, I think this volume suffers because it doesn't have Kate's relationship with her father in it. Now, I know I'm prone to father stories, but her father's also a central character in Elegy. He's kind of her mission giver and her mentor. And he's not present because of story reasons. They're fighting with each other, and I thought that hurt. I like that she's this kind of self-made, street-level character. Her vulnerabilities seem real to me. She can get hurt. She can die. Her powers are based on training, her equipment, her planning. She's like what Batman used to be before Batman became this living legend.
So here's one of my problems with it, actually, is that I didn't understand why she's ever Batwoman. Like, Batman has this origin that's basically very tied into the whole icon of a bat, right? And he's got a bat cave, and he's got stuff that emotionally ties him with being a bat. I don't understand why she's Batwoman and not somebody else.
And it's a fault of the story they don't tell it, and it's a weakness in the character. The reason she's Batwoman is...
So that's why I think... And now I'm kind of coming to it. That's actually why I had problems with it.
Well, there's two reasons she's Batwoman. One is to protect the trademark. Okay, that's the obvious reason.
Less interesting to a reader than maybe DC thinks.
She's Batwoman for the same reason Captain Marvel is Captain Marvel, and Spider-Woman is Spider-Woman, and Ms. Marvel is Ms. Marvel.
Right.
But as I recall, and I'm far from an encyclopedic source on Batwoman, as I recall, she adapts the symbol of the bat because she admires Batman, and she says, I want to be like him, I want to emulate him. He's my
hero. I never got that from this book.
Well, it's not here. None of it's here, and that's the problem, is that this is a continuation of a very kind of dense internal story from before the reboot. You're going to be lost. Even us who read it, you don't remember it.
I honestly don't remember it.
But I read it and consider myself a fan. I read it a couple times. Even I'm kind of going, why the hell does she want to be Batwoman? Right. Mm-hmm. So those are all problems with the book. But I think on balance, I'd still give it a weak recommendation. Certainly anybody that liked the previous incarnation of the character in Elegy, mm-hmm. I think would be very at home here. Now, I understand there's a creative team change coming. I mean, it'll be in the past for people that are reading the book, but for people that are going to look for the next collection, I understand there's a creative team change in the next volume, which didn't go down very well. So it might be that I'm done with this character. Just said I don't go down with the ship with anybody. And if the book loses its high level of quality, then it's
right.
Then why, right?
It is a very high quality book.
Yeah. So for the next one, I don't know if I'll stick with it or not. I'll probably check it out in the store and then see if the creative team changes back. But I really like the character. I like the character more than the story. I'll give you that. Anything? Any other thoughts you want to share? On
no, Batwoman? I actually feel good now that I understand what was bothering me. I don't understand why she's Batwoman.
Yeah,
I understand why she's a superhero.
Right.
I don't understand why she's Batwoman.
I agree.
Based on the story.
I agree. It is such an eternal story because it's about her problems with her sister and her father and and her her relationships and her guilt and all the rest of these things. Potentially great story on the way, but we're sort of in the middle of it here. So what do we give it? How do you rate this one, Mr. Ron?
I'm going to give this one a 2, and I wouldn't come
you
back
swine.
To it.
You swine.
Yeah.
No, you're grading on the curve. 2 and down. Okay.
You know, my original was a 3, but the more I'm thinking about it, it's like I think that they needed to, in this book in particular, they needed me to understand why she was Batwoman and not just a superhero.
Right.
And so I drop it from a 3 to a 2.
Well, I also give it a 3 because I'm the Russian judge, right? And I was going to say I'm not going to buy the next one, but because you've just broke it off in Batwoman and said you're not buying the next one and graded it down to a 2, I will say I'm going to buy the next one. Just so it's not
they're
quite
all spite.
It's not quite so bleak. Speaking of bleak, our next title is I, Vampire by Joshua Hale Fialkov and Andrea Sorrentino. Volume 1, Tainted Love. This book was a real surprise to me. I hate vampire stuff, right? You're far more a vampire guy than I am, but that's just because you like Buffy. You probably don't really care for vampires much.
No, I like some other vampires,
you
know, too.
I'm not known. You're a little interested. iVampire. I ended up buying iVampire just to like fill out my shopping cart. What happened is I was at Barnes & Noble one night, and they had get 3 graphic novels for the price of 2. Mm-hmm. And I grabbed Justice League Dark and Demon Knights, and I was like, yeah, what else? My vampire. Okay, I flipped through it. And actually, I turned to my Twitter feed and asked. It was kind of cool. I was asked my Twitter feed, which book should I get? And enough people waited and said,
how much of a nerd are you, really? I mean, this is...
Count the ways.
this is pretty high advanced nerdism.
We're already an hour into the podcast here, and I don't want to keep people longer than we have to. So, but I turned to my Twitter feed and said, should I try iVampire? And they were like, yeah, give it a go. It's a good book. You'll like it. You know, it's better than you think. So I thought, okay, what the heck? It's basically free. I'll try it. And I'm glad I did because I ended up quite liking it. But I don't like vampire stuff at all. iVampire, let's see, what's my description here? It's the story of Andrew Bennett and his ex-lover, Bloody Mary, two ancient vampires with very different ideas about how to live their unlives, with Mary wanting to lead vampires out of the shadows to their rightful destiny as rulers of mankind, and Bennett living a lonely life of the vampire hunter, turned against his own kind, manfully resisting his own bloodlust, and trying to transform himself and his tribe into some new kind of undead. If it was just about vampires, I wouldn't like it so much, but it does interact with the DC continuity, Gotham City. Our story finds our characters in Gotham City for a team-up with Batman, which surprised me, but I thought it was pretty good. Mary's diabolical plot unfolds, and much blood is shed. The book was a surprise to me, a pleasant surprise. Don't normally go for vampire stuff. I'm a big fan of Tomb of Dracula, of course, from the 70s, but that's kind of traditional vampire. But I liked the characters. I liked the take on the vampire mythos. It had just enough twists and turns, I thought, to be its own unique thing. What do you think of iVampire?
I think I'm out. What I put as my nutshell on this one was Dark Shallows.
Okay.
Meaning that, I really felt like this wasn't really a paranormal romance. It wasn't really a superhero book. It wasn't really a good horror tale. I wasn't really sure what it was.
Okay, I can see that.
I can see, I kind of came at it with a little higher expectation because you said it was good.
I said it surprised me.
That's right.
I said I don't normally like vampire stuff.
I raised my stuff. So yeah. For vampires, I thought that I didn't really get anything new out of this from all the other vampire stuff that's coming on. On the other hand, it didn't do the stuff that some of the vampire stuff that's out there now, whether it's Vampire Diaries or even, God help us.
You watch Vampire Diaries?
Lori watches Vampire Diaries, and I have to sit there and see it. Yes, I watch Vampire
you watch
Diaries.
You watch Twilight?
Yes, I've seen Twilight. I've seen all the Twilight ones. I've got a house full of women. I've got a wife and 3 daughters. They're all into the paranormal romance. I know the paranormal romance.
And God bless them. Like, I write a comic book blog. We're on a comic book podcast. It's the biggest glass house on the internet. I'm not throwing rocks at anybody.
Yes, you are. Okay? You're throwing rocks.
But tell me, please, that you're looking at your iPad when you're watching these things at home.
I pretend to.
Okay.
I pretend to. But what I'm saying is that most of the vampire is all about sexuality. The vampire is all about relationships. That's what it's all about. That's why it's so fascinating to so many, particularly in women, right? Mm-hmm. And this one just didn't hit any of the things that I was looking for, either on that side or on the other side.
Maybe that's why I like it. It's vampirism with all the weepy, gothic teen angst kind of pulled out of it. That's why I like Tomb of Dracula, too.
Yeah. And in fairness, it is a much better story than actual Dark Shadows that just came out, which I happened to have to see at my house, which was not very good.
You're talking about the Johnny Depp
picture? The Johnny Depp picture, which was fairly awful.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, iVampire, I give it 2 stars.
You're getting harsh. Well, again, perhaps because I expected so little, I found myself caught up in it. I thought it was a page turner. I mean, I read it once. I read it late at night. It's like, oh, I'm going to give this up and read the rest in the morning. It's like, that was a good chapter. I'll read the next one. I thought the storytelling was sometimes too clever, a little hard to follow. But again, I like the characters, I like the concepts. I guess I like that it was telling me that there was this substrata of vampire society that had existed inside the DC universe all this time, and now they're getting ready to come out of the shadows, and it was going to be a big deal. And I thought that they paid that off by introducing Batman, who was pretty good, I thought, in his cameo, not really a cameo, but in his guest appearance here. I thought
his
character was well handled. So I liked the way that was integrated. And I liked... Bloody Mary was kind of, just if she had a mustache, she would have twirled it. She wasn't an especially.
Why did she hate everybody? Well, it's because she hated everybody.
Yeah, she was.
I never understood why she was Bloody Mary.
I agree with that, but I kind of liked Andrew Bennett. I mean, he's no Blade, right? But I like that he was at war with his nature. I like that he's the sire of all these other vampires and should be their leader, but is saying, look, there's a different way we can be here. He's like a vampire Gandhi for crying out loud.
But he told us he was at war with his nature. To be fair, from your criticism right on other books, he never showed us that. I never saw him really tormented or having to make a decision. What I saw him is him telling us who he was.
He's a little preachy, but he gets jumped by people and he holds back and doesn't transform into a monster as much as he could. And
that's true.
Maybe he isn't mooning about on the battlements too much and lamenting his inability to drink blood, but it was there, I thought. And the book does come to me to a somewhat surprising conclusion, which I see now as the same ending as we have in Justice League Dark. I don't know if you recognize that or not, but it's the bringing back this. Well, I don't want to spoil anything, but there's a supernatural character from the old days of DC that's reintroduced into the universe. Ah. Both characters. So in the very last,
I did not make that connection. But yeah, I did think about it. You're right.
It didn't make any. But at the very last page here, they jump to Madame Xanadu going, "It's too late. He's loose. Right. He's free." And it doesn't. I don't know why it connected until I read these two things together.
Yeah.
So that I also thought was kind of interesting. I don't know if interesting equals good or not. I'm giving it a kind of a weak endorsement. I only give it 3 stars, but I would buy the next one. What do you say?
I'd give it 2 stars, and here's the perverse thing. I would probably buy the next one.
Okay,
I kind of want to know what's going to happen and give it another shot. Plus, I think I'd let my kids and Lori read it.
Okay,
they might like it. So,
maybe I'll buy a vampire, and you can buy Animal Man, and then we can trade them. Right. So yeah, I mean,
I have to reiterate to anybody who's listening to this podcast, these books I've been actually just shocked from my background in comics at how consistently good all the new 52 books are.
Yeah.
And so, it's really hard for me to give anything. I didn't give anything a 1 star, not even Frankenstein, which I didn't like at all.
I don't give anything 1 star. But I only give 1 5.
And I would give plenty of other comics a 1 star. So mm-hmm. The editorial team deserves a lot of credit for these. And the creators, of course.
All right, well, huzzah for the new 52 so far. The few 52. We're about halfway done here. The next volume we will discuss is Supergirl. Volume 1, Last Daughter of Krypton, which you bought and loaned to me. And this is never a book I would have bought. But I really enjoyed it. I'm glad that you loaned it to me. It's Michael Green, Mike Johnson, and Mahmoud Asrar. The story is Supergirl comes to Earth, wakes up in her capsule, doesn't know how she got here, runs amok, beating up powered armor mooks and even her cousin Superman, who she doesn't recognize because she last saw him when she was babysitting him as an infant, which I thought was a real neat little twist.
Mm-hmm.
Slam bang, straight ahead superhero tale, broad shouldered, a lot of battling back and forth, and kind of superhero action where people get knocked over the horizon and through buildings. There's 2 stories here, maybe 3. We've got Supergirl's origin tale where she comes to Earth and tangles with Superman, then Supergirl getting mixed up with an evil industrious named Simon Tycho,
mm-hmm.
who examines and tortures our heroine on his orbital laboratory. And then there's a battle against the World Killer, these cosmic super soldiers somehow connected to Krypton, who has slipped off the leash and now make war on everyone. What did you think of Supergirl, Mr. Ohm?
I liked it quite a bit. I wanted to like it. First of all, I'm going to say I wanted to like it. I've always wanted to like Supergirl.
Well, who wouldn't? I mean, she's got the shorts and the cape and the hair, and she's perpetually innocent, but she flies through space. That's a pretty cool girlfriend.
Yeah, she's pretty awesome, and I really wanted to like her. I thought that the origin was very understandable. I just wish it didn't go on for so long. I felt like 4 or 5 issues of pretty much the same origin story. Yeah, she's a an amnesiac, which I always like amnesia stories.
Mm-hmm. So your girlfriends can't remember you.
Yeah, that's right. So I really liked it. What I would like to see, first of all, I'm going to say, look, 4 stars for me. I'm definitely, the artwork is terrific. The storytelling is terrific. I liked Simon Tycho as a bad guy.
Really, I thought he was a little Lex Luthor-ish.
Yeah, that's why I liked him.
Okay.
Here's what I wanted to see, and this is what I'm expecting going forward. If I don't get this, the next volume I'll probably drop the series.
Okay.
I want a supporting cast, and I want her to actually have a life. I want her to have a Peter Parker-ish life that's not, I want to see a fish out of water with a Kryptonian that's trying to adapt to Earth that has no understanding at all of Earth. I love the fact that she didn't have any understanding of it. She's coming straight from Krypton.
That's what she is now. She doesn't speak the language, interactions with her cousin, who she doesn't really trust and doesn't believe he's Superman, and also with these memories of her parents.
She's going to have to get a job. She's going to have to fit in somehow to Earth.
Yeah.
And how does she do that? That actually interests me. I think that's a really interesting question. And how the creative team answers that question will make the difference between me wanting to be a fan of this series for a long time or not.
But you'll buy the next one.
Oh, definitely. I'm in for the next one. And, yeah. and the artwork is just tremendous. I thought the artwork was great. And this book has a huge headroom. Whereas, like, go back to Frankson. I have to pick on Frankson. Frankson had no headroom.
Right? You are picking. He's got gigantic headroom. He's got this huge head with bolts. And
it absorbed. That book absorbed all the headroom in the first, like, 20 pages, right? This one has a huge amount of stories that can be told. And a lot of character development. And I think anybody should stick with Supergirl. It's good. It's
I agree. I'm also giving it 4 stars and a buy recommendation. However, I did think it's not quite as acute as it was in Animal Man. I thought that the conclusion of the book was a little weak. I didn't really like these world killer characters very much.
It felt like Deus Ex Machina to me when they just kind of showed up. And
this character, Rain, who shows up and gives this panel after panel of expository dialogue explaining who she is and why she's here and you know, hinting at this terrible secret that she won't go ahead and tell us. That kind of wore me out a little bit, and if that's the trend, then I'm not going to be crazy about where the book goes. But I'm gonna say that was
The only advice I'd give at this point to that book is I want to see it being brought down to earth a little bit. It's real cosmic right now. It's got lots of big shoulders.
Well, you know, I love the cosmic. I love the big shoulders. This is the only book we're looking at today that Jack Kirby could have done.
Yeah, but I also want the Stan Lee touch. I want a family story in there someplace that somehow she gets a job at Starbucks or something. Something happens that is a counterpoint to all this craziness. Otherwise, it's going to be, well, you know, book I hate, Frankenstein.
Yeah. Well, she does need a mentor, right? She needs a sponsor. Who's is it going to be? Of course, it's pointless for us to speculate because the book's...
Yeah, they're already out.
Yeah, it's gone another 6 weeks, and our readers or listeners probably have read it and know the answers. But looking at it here... I kind of do wonder who's going to take her under their wing and what the next chapter in her life will be.
If she just had to figure it out on her own, too. That could be interesting. She's every college kid, you know, is the way I view it.
So my notes, I say a simple and fun superhero fist opera, not too deep, but entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
Blink and you miss it. This is a very fast-paced book. You can read this in about 45 minutes.
That was the fastest read. I think it was a two-dumper.
Yeah, okay. One dumper for you.
especially as I've gotten older.
I like Kara. I like the character. She wears her heart on her sleeve, thinks with her fists.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. She's a hothead. She's headstrong. She has.
But she's got a good heart, too. She's not. She's definitely not an anti-hero. Right? Yeah, and she's not tormented or tortured. She's just confused.
Her freakouts are entertaining and plausible, let's say.
That's right.
Her emotional attachment to her lost planet, her dead parents, it's a little sappy, but it's effective, and it works well in the context
of
the character.
It's believable. Yeah.
I mentioned I didn't like the world killers very much. Low density storytelling goes really fast. I don't know that much about Supergirl. I know a little bit because I've been reading the original Legion of Superheroes stories, which were published in Adventure and Superboy comics in the late 50s, early 60s. And Supergirl appears there, right?
Yeah, do you know when she first appeared? What year?
I would say 58.
59. Pretty good. Pretty good off the top of your head. Okay. Pretty good.
So my note here is this isn't your father's Supergirl, really your grandfather's Supergirl.
Yeah.
The character is far removed from Superman's innocent Silver Age cousin. There's no Streaky here, the Wonder Cat. I miss her.
Yeah, we need Streaky.
You need Streaky. And
somehow.
There's no Super Horse. There's no Kryptonian.
What was the Super Horse's name? Do you remember?
Super Horse, I think.
No, it was not.
Comet.
Comet. There you go.
There's no Kryptonian girl hiding in an Earth orphanage. For all that, there's still innocence here. I think innocence is core to that character and to this character. Kara is still a babe in the woods, still deeply attached to a world that is gone forever. I liked her.
Yeah.
I liked her stories.
I'm with you.
Okay, so we're both giving her four stars and a
four
buy.
Stars. Well, four
so,
stars and a buy.
So far, that's our... She's the gold standard. That what is again?
Well, that's surprising for both of us, right? Because a lot of anti-hero books that you would have thought would have been our touchstone.
Yeah, plus, I mean, to be fair, both of us are kind of maybe going to steer away from these books that are... The corporate trademarks, the corporate icons. You know, the ones that are going to get the most scrutiny, they got to play it down Main Street.
But, you know, I liked it. I actually wanted it to be played. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, and I think neither one of us could be described as Superman fans. I like the character. You have actually kind of an active dislike for the character.
It's not that I have a dislike for it. It's just that Superman is one of those guys that he can do everything.
Yeah, but I like the mythos, and I rarely enjoy reading the issues, but I'd be happy to wear a Superman shirt. I care for the character. I'm sitting here wearing a Spider-Man shirt, so you can't laugh too much. But, I was pleasantly surprised. It's the most I've enjoyed any Superman-style book, really, since the 1980s Man of Steel.
Oh, it's my favorite by far for the last... Probably the last 30 books I've read on Superman.
Okay, so Supergirl, strong recommendation from Chris Olin and Paul O'Connor here at Longbox Graveyard. So next title, anything else you want on Supergirl before we
No, buy it. It's good. It's a good book.
Buy it, I agree. All right, so next one is Demon Knights, Volume 1, Seven Against the Dark, by Paul Cornell, Diogenes Neves. That's a great name. That should be a character yeah. in the game.
Should be a villain.
Yeah. And Eau Claire Albert, or Albert, probably. Demonites, Volume 1. These are DC's medieval superheroes doing their version of Seven Samurai. They're defending a medieval town against the horde of the questing queen, a demonic army of barbarians and dragons. This book is all action, all characterization through action, which is the way I like comics, and this, it reminds me of Chris Claremont's X-Men. That's high praise. The main characters all do their shtick, reveal more to the audience than they do to themselves, predictably misunderstand each other, and generate all sorts of internal tension that's broken only by the next monster attack. The book shouldn't work, but it does. It's a grab bag of bizarre characters, though to be fair, I have a weakness for DC's backbench characters, and there's a whole bunch of them here. We got Madame Xanadu, who I liked here, but not so much in Justice League Dark.
I liked her much better here.
Vandal Savage, Shining Knight,
Questing Queen, Mordru.
Yeah, just...
Jason Blood, right? And the demon?
The demon, Etrigan, who here is kind of a medieval version of the Incredible Hulk,
right?
Which I quite enjoyed. Now, I'm a Jack Kirby fan, but I know very little about the demon. I don't know how Demon fans are going to react to this, but I tell you what, I like this book a lot. And it was another one that was kind of a surprise to me. I didn't expect to like it, but I really enjoyed it. Well, how about you, Mr. Cohen?
I think I liked it less. What I said is that this was Dungeons and Samurai. It's kind of hitting, it obviously is mixing those two things together, Dungeons and Dragons and the Seven Samurai. I liked the relationship between Jason Blood and his girlfriend. I'm spacing out her name right now.
Was any palling around with Xanadu? I thought it was Madame Xanadu.
No, I'm not sure which one it was.
All right, I'll figure it out. I'll look.
Yeah, but anyway, I thought the relationships were kind of interesting. I really liked Vandal Savage. Kind of a horrible creature. He's kind of a good guy and a bad guy. You don't know which way he stands.
But in the DC firmament, he's a bad guy. So seeing him here as kind of a roguish good guy is interesting.
So pushing the whole favorite sandwich thing, I think this is a favorite sandwich that I should love, and I do like it. I think the artwork is fantastic. This is my I think this is my favorite artwork of any of the books we looked at. It's just gorgeous. Very, very nice. And the story is told pretty well, I think. But for some reason, I found it less than the sum of its parts. It's a team book where they're moving a lot of chess pieces around, and there's a lot of sort of skipping over things and not really focusing on each character. You don't get a sense of who each character is. It's a lot of characters that have to be serviced in the story.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, I would buy the next one for sure.
Yeah, I'd buy the next
one. And I think what I gave it was a, I actually gave it, you won't let me give it a half.
No halves.
So my quality level,
pick
I think.
A team.
I'm going to say this. I'm going to give you my understanding of what it is, and I'll give you my final score. The quality level, I think, of the book, by the writing and the art, is a four stars.
Mm-hmm.
And how much I liked it was a 3-star. So I'm going to go ahead and bounce it up and give it 4 stars.
Okay, I can go for that. I mean, for me, yeah, it is a favorite sandwich, but it's a favorite sandwich of all the stuff I like.
Yeah, it really is. And it's also, it has a lot of energy, but it does have characterization. It does have heart to it. It does do things that, say, the Frankenstein books didn't do, so I think I have to give it a 4-star.
I agree with all those, and especially I do agree it compares favorably with the Frankenstein book, which maybe is, I could best clarify or characterize as a guilty pleasure. But this book, I think, has a lot to offer, and I did compare it to early X-Men, because it does have that sense of you're joining the story in progress, and all the characters have got their problems that seem really internal but are all on the outside. So as a reader, you feel like you're brought into a world and you understand the characters better than they understand themselves. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And I like some of the characters. I like the Shining Knight. I liked Al-Jabbar.
Yeah.
Madame Xanadu. And I like the Amazon. Right?
She's like a prototype Wonder Woman, right?
Yeah, yeah. I like the idea that there's an early version of an Amazon.
Yeah.
And
this is set. This is like
strong women characters too, which I kind of like the fact that there were different kinds of women characters in the series right from the beginning.
A lot of them, yeah. And I mentioned it's a favorite sandwich and my favorite thing, so I do have vulnerabilities to it. I like I like medieval mud and blood stories. I like the Arthurian backstory and connection. I like the demon a lot. I suppose I've just to keep my Longbox Graveyard membership card, I need to go scare up the Jack Kirby omnibus and read the character in his original form. The only familiarity I had with him prior to this is like his guest appearances in Alan Moore's Swamp Things.
That's the only time I'd ever seen him too.
And he was a little tiresome there because he rhymes and I don't really know what the heck he was about. But here he's a bad guy. You know, when you let him loose, it's a very ambivalent kind of
things.
Yeah, he tears a priest's face off, and he's a beast. He's a monster. He's a demon.
He's a demon.
He's a demon. And So he surprised me a little bit. And the villains were a little bloodless, but they're at least they have...
Villains were probably the worst part.
Yeah.
They just seemed like they just kept, you know, sort of kept it going.
Yeah, but the spear carriers are pretty cool. You know, just the monsters and the dragons and the raptor attacks and all the crazy
stuff.
Oh,
the art is just fantastic. I just really, really enjoyed the art.
Yeah. So, yeah, so I gave this... I also gave Demon Knights 4 stars and a buy recommendation. And you're kind of leaning to a 4.
Yeah. Yeah, I would.
So it's not quite as even though at the, in the summary we're gonna both this and Supergirl would be 8 out of 10 with a buy recommendation. You'd put Supergirl ahead of this, I think. If you only had
I'm gonna call this one a 3. I'm gonna call this one a 3. Okay, just to be fair, so 3 and a buy and a strong buy.
Okay, 3 and a buy. But yeah, it's it quite surprised me. And boy, I don't know any of these characters. I should say, in the unlikely event there's someone that Shining Knight is their favorite character of all time, Shining Knight in this book is female. But no one's allowed to mention it.
Yeah. And she looks kind of like a boy.
Yeah, she's boyish, but not above the hips. So she's a little confusing. But
I found myself confused.
She makes me feel strange. Like I'm climbing the rope in gym class. Yeah, Demon Knights, cool. And another book I wouldn't have bought without the... about getting a firm push from my Twitter feed. So thanks, Twitter folks.
Yeah. We have Aquaman, right?
Yes, we have Aquaman. We also have Batman. Why don't we do Batman next?
Okay.
I know you're not prepared for this, but we did read it some time ago. Batman Volume 1, Court of Owls.
Yeah.
By Scott Snyder, Greg Capullo, and Jonathan Glapion. Sorry for mangling your name there, Jonathan. I'm on my third beer. This was the first of the new 52 books that I read. Bought it in hardback when it came out. I loaned it on to you. You read it. And I haven't read it in probably since it came out.
And we gabbed about it as soon as we both had read it.
Yeah. But we loaned it on to another friend. We didn't get it back in time for it to review prior to this podcast. So I'm not going to have any real specific notes on it, aside from saying that, A, the story is Batman, as I recall... it's Batman discovering this monstrous conspiracy, secret society, the heart of Gotham, the Court of Owls, these guys.
Which I liked. That secret society thing was really pretty cool.
Yeah, which is telegraphed in All-Star Western, by the way, if you look closely.
Yeah, I know. Which I thought was pretty neat.
So he encounters this secret society, and he gets put in a labyrinth, and he gets the snot kicked out of him. And it's well-drawn, and it's by the guy that's been doing Batman for a long time, I think, for DC. Again, we have no history with him, but I think it was familiar to fans.
I don't think it was a total revamp. I think they held on to some of the stuff that had happened before.
And that's one of the things I remember you remarking on after I gave it to you. You said, hey, I thought this was a pretty good Batman book, but as a lapsed reader, you expected to get more because it started in the middle.
It didn't feel like an origin story to me of Batman, which is what I thought that the New 52 was going to do.
Well, to be fair, the origin of Batman is pretty familiar.
Well, a revamp of the origin of Batman. I just didn't understand it. Now, having read, I think having read more of the books now, I'm going to soften my initial criticism for the Batman book. I thought it was actually a very well told tale. One of my favorite, I think I told you at the time, it was one of my favorite Batman stories that I had read. So I think I'd give that one a 3 or a 4. Mm-hmm. And definitely I'm going to keep reading Batman.
Oh, you would?
Yeah.
See, I don't think I'd get the next one. And the reason is...
I would.
I give it 4 stars, but no buy, right?
Wow. That's weird.
Well, it's because the book, to me... And again, I'm groping a little bit.
So I give it 3 stars and a buy.
Yeah, and I say 4 and no buy. Which means I'll read yours. But the thing is that, to me, the book read as a prelude to a larger story. And for me, the first sniff I get of... line-wide crossover, multiple book, team-up nonsense. That's, you know, I can't hit the door fast enough. And the sense I got coming out of this was, okay, now go read these other 7 Court of Owls books. Go read Talon. Go read, you know, how does this impact?
I forgot about that. Yeah, see, I don't like that. I don't want to be plugged into a bigger story. The Civil War thing from Marvel just blew me out of that forever.
So I just don't want to do that. Now, since then, I think I mentioned that to a friend on Twitter who said, oh, no, it's okay. You can just read the next Batman and it works by itself. So that might encourage me to go back in because I do like the character. I do recall thinking the story was a little slow evolving. It's very decompressed, right for the trade style pace where you can go through, you know, panels and panels where Batman is just kind of grunting or puzzling things out. It doesn't move at a very fast pace, but it certainly was well drawn and it was intriguing. That, you know, it's always a little suspicious when a a world as well understood as Gotham turns out to have had these guys for the last 100 years, and this is the first we're encountering them, right? But that's artificial. That's external to the story, and maybe that's a license you grant because they are doing this kind of reboot.
Yeah, and Gotham's kind of an endless, you know, endless sewer of bad guys, right? So I don't mind that there's layers upon layers in Gotham.
And in that sense, I suppose it's bold that if you're going to reinvent Batman, that you introduce this whole new villainous society, that you, because he has the richest rogues gallery in all of comics.
Right.
You could do
by
a different
by far.
Yeah, you could do a different Batman villain every month for 3-4 years and not really, you know, I get down, I suppose by the time you get down to Crazy Quilt and
Counterman,
maybe
the first year you'd
maybe 12 months.
I mean, the movies couldn't even do it in 3 movies, so yeah.
Well, that's because they triple up, you know, they put multiple guys in the same but it did give us a face of Batman that we hadn't seen before, I suppose.
And it was very well told. I mean, it was the creators did a great job, I think, on the series. And it's tough with a character like Batman when there's so many other stories. There's Batman and Robin book, and there's just tons and tons of stuff going on.
Well, he's hideously overexposed, of course, because that's what's selling. And you know you're getting a lot of help, a lot of editorial scrutiny when you're handling
crazy. I thought I wouldn't want to go back and read another Batman. I thought I would I'd be more focused on these more minor characters like Supergirl. Because it's going to be only a single book. I just don't want to do these crossover books anymore. But the fact they got me roped in and I want to read more Batman says a lot about the creative team. I urge people that listen to this podcast, they should get the Batman book.
And this is Batman. It's not one of the other titles. It is the flagship Batman title. It's not Detective. It's not Batman and Robin. Right. It's not Dark Knight. It's not Batwing. It's not Batwoman, right? There's so many of them.
So what's your score?
I give it 4 stars, but no buy because I smelled a crossover coming. But you know,
so
maybe
3 stars and a buy. I'll stick with it, and you can read mine.
You go 3, you don't go 4.
Yeah,
as much as you recommend it.
Yeah, I just, you know, if it was just this story, maybe I wouldn't keep on going. But I think there's a lot of promise going forward.
I agree with that. For the most part, we've avoided in our review of the few 52. We've avoided the big. We've avoided all the Super Friends characters, right? We're not looking at the Flash or Wonder Woman
or Superman,
you know, in either his own book or in action.
Green Lantern.
No, right?
these are all we're kind of on the periphery.
We didn't get Justice League, which was very much their flagship book. It's what they led New 52 with.
Maybe we should do another one and focus on those books.
Or maybe not. Maybe we could while we're ahead. Because to be fair, I mean, one of the reasons maybe we're enjoying this stuff as much as we are is that they're. We don't have a lot of expectations. Out there, there's somebody that's probably, he's really grinding his gears because we like the demon, and it has nothing to do with the way Jack Kirby created the character, or they're angry at...
I hope they write to you, and they tell you how
I hope they will. I hope they rant, you know. It's my job to feel crazy nerd rage rants, or Animal Man, or any of these characters. You know, maybe there's one guy somewhere that's a fan of the original Kathy Kane Batwoman that's just... incensed that she's a lesbian. It's like, oh, this is nonsense, you know, the original character.
How could they
do this?
How could they do that to that bad guy?
It's not right. It's not realistic at all. Alright, so Batman, 4 stars, no buy for me, 3 stars and a buy for you.
Yeah,
I kind of give it an incomplete. I'm taking counsel of my fears here because I'm afraid of crossovers. Maybe I should just get over myself. So let's get on to our next book.
Aquaman,
Volume 1, The Trench, by Jeff Johns.
Another terrible subtitle. Really, come on. Hydrology, The Trench. You can't, guys, do better.
Now, one of James Bond's first girlfriends was Sylvia Trench. I don't think that's who they mean here.
Trench galore.
Sylvia Trench is interesting. She actually appears in 2 James Bond pictures. I don't think there's ever been a woman.
That's not interesting.
It's interesting to me. She's in Casino Royale. She's in Dr. No, and then she's also in From Russia with Love. So early on, James Bond was like seeing the same girl.
Look, Trench, not a great name. Pussy galore, great name.
Yeah. True.
That's true. You
but Pussy Galore was like Batwoman. She was batting for the other side. I mean,
I don't care.
James Bond rolls around with her in the hay for a little while, literally, and then changes her ways, right? Cures her of that.
He has that ability.
He does. He's James Bond. So anyway, setting aside Sylvia Trench, Aquaman, Volume 1, The Trench, by Jeff Johns, Ivan Rice, and Joe Prado. I didn't write a summary of this. Do you have a summary of what it was about? It's like there's 2 stories, right? There's these evil...
Basically, they go back to the bay. What's their bay that they're going back to?
I don't know. They live in... It probably matters with Aquaman fans, but we don't care about Aquaman fans.
Yeah,
right?
Amnesty Bay.
Amnesty Bay.
So they go back to Amnesty Bay. Yeah, and it's Aquaman and Mira, and Aquaman's kind of trying to figure out who he is.
Right. And these terrible fish creatures bubble up out of the hole in the water.
Fish come out from the trench, and they eat people, and then but they're misunderstood, and it's about Aquaman and Mira, and it's about Mira trying to fit into the society of Amnesty Bay.
Right, trying to go shopping.
I love this story. I love this book.
Yeah.
I think this book is great. I think that they took the fact that Aquaman's been made fun of for 20 years, and they actually rolled it into the character. They hung a lantern on it, right? They just said, this is the way that that everyone thinks about Aquaman, so we're going to kind of go from here. And I think that was really smart. That was a really smart way to go.
But isn't that kind of a Daffy Duck trick? You know, is it a trick you can do more than once?
No, I think you can. I think actually, of all the series, this one felt more like a pilot for a TV show.
Yeah, I'll give you that.
I thought Mira was great.
Mira was awesome.
Yeah, I thought she was a great character.
Yeah.
I thought Aquaman, I didn't know where he was going to go. And that was actually kind of cool, too. They made him super powerful, but at the same time, he's very restrained.
I note here, I like the otherness of both Aquaman and Mira. They seem vaguely alien, truly from a different culture, didn't actually fit in.
I love that part. Let's see. I really like the book. It feels like a high-quality cable series to me. It really does. Feels like a, you know, AMC story or something like that. It feels like it would be a better show than The Arrow, which I think is a pretty good show.
Mm-hmm.
So
they tried to do Aquaman in Smallville at one point, didn't they? Didn't they have it some... after I checked out, I thought they did Aquaman on that show. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm confusing it with Man from Atlantis.
No, I you know, they haven't really... I mean, Aquaman's never gotten the respect he deserves.
I love Aquaman and Brave and the Bold, the cartoon series. I know you're not you haven't seen a lot.
I haven't seen a lot of them, but I think it's, you know,
that was the beginning of his rehabilitation. But there he's a clown. You know, he's just a lot of fun. He's comic relief. Here it's a serious Aquaman.
Yeah, I don't think Aquaman has to be a clown. I think he can be a great character.
Well, this book proves he doesn't have to be a clown.
But you know, I was in comics, right? They cut off his hand and made him Hook Hand. That was the big.
That's right.
You know, made him grim. Everybody was grim. Everybody was carrying a machine gun or had a Hook Hand, right? And so
it's kind of hard to operate a machine gun with a hook hand.
So they gave Aquaman a that was their big leap forward, was giving him a hook hand. And I always hated it. And they gave him a beard later, and then he had long flowing hair and a beard. And
shirtless.
He rode on top of a shark or whatever. It just was like, it was bad. This Aquaman, I think, is great. I think I highly recommend it, and I give it 4 stars.
I
will buy it. I'm going to buy the next one. I'm first in line to buy the next one.
I give you one better. I give it 5 stars. It's the only New 52 I give 5 stars, because it mostly for degree of difficulty, because it does make Aquaman
pulls it off cool.
But I'm telling you what, I want to... You know, it works for 6 issues. I'm not sure it works for 12. And the reason is that we still don't... The reinvention
is a fish out of water story.
Yeah, okay, thank you very much. All right, it's also a Shaggy Dog story, if you want to be right on the nose. But the thing is, it doesn't really change Aquaman. I don't know anything more about Aquaman going into this than I did coming out.
It's got headroom. It's got a huge headroom.
Yeah, you in the headroom. Thanks,
headroom.
Max.
It's got a huge headroom.
Listen, the thing is that...
And I'm intrigued. Aren't you intrigued?
Of course I'm intrigued. And I gave it 5 stars and
that's
a 5.
That's what I'm saying. You're intrigued.
Get off my back.
Give it some time.
But I got to tell you, it's also my job to criticize it. What's going on here? It's not my job.
That's really not your job.
No, it really isn't my job. But it's my responsibility. It's my... I can't help myself but criticize and note that... Aquaman
is... You just took off your glasses.
I did. His
re-emphasis.
His reinvention is external. It's entirely external. The only reason that Aquaman feels fresh in this book is because of the way other characters react to him.
And that's perfect, because now we have a chance to do an internal story later.
Yes, and they better. That's why I don't know if it works in 12 issues as well as it works in 6.
That's why there's headroom. That's why I'm saying there's headroom.
Five
stars, and you know what? We got to be next in line for the next graphic novel.
Yeah, I agree.
Because they're going to pull it off. Jeff Johns is going to pull it off. That's who wrote it, right?
Jeff Johns
is going to pull it off.
Yeah, and I thought it was a terrific read. A lot of fun. I also thought, I will note, that the monsters, the fish monsters, the flesh-eating fish monsters in the bottom of the sea, they worked well enough, but they spilled a lot of blood. It seemed to me like they were coming from a different story, because the story is kind of lighthearted, but the stakes are pretty high.
I sort of like that. I thought that was peanut butter and chocolate. Actually, they go well together. They're different, but they go well together. I liked it.
I thought it was a little Michael Bay.
No, I liked it.
Remember how in the opening shot of Armageddon they tell us what the stakes are? You probably don't, but they tell us what the stakes are going to be in Armageddon.
You know what? Armageddon was a good movie. Armageddon was the one Michael Bay movie I actually liked.
Well, I thought it was entertaining too, but I also knew that nothing was at risk in Armageddon, because in the prelude, this gigantic rock. There's a guy walking down the street with a dog on a leash.
Why do you do the Charlie Chaplin? You think you're acting like Charlie Chaplin?
It's for your benefit. So there's a guy walking down the street, and he's got his dog on a leash, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the world is being destroyed, and all these two-dimensional starlets are being killed. We don't care, but everyone goes, "Oh no, the dog! Don't threaten the dog! Right? The dog might die. The poor little dog." and this gigantic rock flies out of the sky and wipes out half of Manhattan and kills the guy walking the dog, and there's a dog standing there with his leash trailing into this smoking pit. That. Okay, perfect. But that tells us exactly what the stakes are in this particular series, which is the dog won't get hurt. Everybody else is fair game. And that happens here. Like, these horrible monsters come slurping out of the sea. They're eating nuns and nurses and firemen. And one of them eats a dog. But they cut that fish open in time to get the dog out.
Of course. I'm in. You know what? If anyone should do Aquaman, it should be Michael Bay. That's perfect. You know what? Great sensibility. I thought that this is the only main character we looked at, isn't it?
Yeah, well, Batman, too.
Batman. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah. But this one, to me, Aquaman, they did a great job of resurrecting. Batman, they just held serve.
Yeah.
Batman's Batman. You can never do anything wrong with Batman. You're never going to cancel a Batman book.
Yeah. So, I give it 5 stars for degree of difficulty. A big thumbs up. You're giving it a 4 and up?
I'll give it a 4 and up.
Yeah, I'm really picking
that. It's not my favorite of the books, but it's in my top 3 of the books that we reviewed.
Yeah. Well, he's not my favorite character either, and I'm really picking nits to find problems with it. And I will look forward to the next one. Congratulations to the team and to DC for making Aquaman relevant and interesting, which is, boy, that's not easy.
Great job. Great job on that one.
Okay, and then we come to our last book here for this particular review, All-Star Western, Volume 1, Guns and Gotham, by Justin Gray, Jimmy Palmiotti, Moritat, Phil Winslade, and Jordi Burnett. Burnett? Is that how we say it?
Maybe it's Burnett.
Okay. The only one we really know, we know Jimmy Palmiotti.
Jimmy Palmiotti very well, and Jimmy is a brilliant creator.
Jimmy, I don't know did he get a start with Malibu? Was it his first
work? I don't know if it was his first, but certainly we worked with Jimmy for a long time.
And his first work, right?
Yes. Yeah. And you know, he did many, many covers for us, many books.
Jimmy inked one of my covers when I was writing New Humans.
Jimmy is a very talented, he can do everything. He can do writing, art, everything.
Very kind guy. And I've had a Twitter exchange with him recently where he wished us both well, which was nice. So maybe he's amnesiac. Maybe he was sitting ahead or something. But it certainly pleases us to see Jimmy has done so well in his career.
Before we start on All-Star Western, I have to interject here.
Okay.
I don't like Jonah Hex. I didn't see the Jonah Hex movie.
It was terrible.
Well, and I never liked the character.
Let me tell you about the Jonah Hex
movie. I don't understand the character, to be honest with you.
All right.
So I came into this book with... I actually put this as my last one to read because... Not because of Jimmy, because I love Jimmy Palmiotti as a creator. But just because, A, Westerns I'm kind of burned out because of Dark Watch.
Yeah.
And B, because I never liked Jonah Hex. And, the whole, DC Western thing... Never did anything for me whatsoever.
True.
So I have to kind of give that as a prelude to my review.
Okay.
So go ahead. You were going to say about.
Oh well, it's a total diversion. I did see the Jonah Hex movie, and it was terrible. Josh Brolin and your girlfriend Megan Fox.
No. I'm not a Megan Fox fan.
Everyone's a Megan Fox fan.
No, not me.
But not Variety, who in their review devoted one line to Ms. Fox.
What?
They said Megan Fox was adequate as a whore.
That's the cruelest review I've ever heard.
Isn't it?
That's very bad.
Yeah.
It's very bad.
And it was a terrible, terrible picture. And a picture that never should have been made, because I agree with you. I mean, what is Jonah Hex? Like, these comic book companies, let's do a little comic book history here. These comic companies have all been publishing comics continuously for, 75 years now? So that means...
Yeah, or longer.
Or longer. So that means they had a period in the 50s and the 60s where they were publishing comics. And what was big in the 50s and the 60s?
Westerns,
right? So they've got all these legacy characters. They've got Jonah Hex. They've got
Rawhide Kid.
Vigilante. And they have to renew their copyright, their trademarks every once in a while and use them for various things. So they're part of the DNA of comic books. But yeah, I agree, in terms of pop culture, we've moved away from Westerns being really vital. You might get a decent Western picture once every 2 or 3 years. Might be kind of an event, but it's not like it was when Gunsmoke was the top show on television, and every time you go to the movies, there'd be a B-Western, right?
So I'm going to jump in here and say, so I expected to not only dislike this, but to try to come up with some reason that I wouldn't hurt Jimmy's feelings, as we were talking about the podcast.
I think Jimmy can take
but
it at this
here's,
point. But
here's the deal. Yeah. This is my favorite book.
This is the best one.
This is my favorite book of all the books that we reviewed. I thought it was a high quality, great book. I am now a Jonah Hex fan as a result.
Wow.
5 stars.
5.
I can't wait to read the next one. I thought I loved 1880s version of Gotham City. That's I liked clever. The storyline. I liked Amadeus Arkham as the supercilious sidekick to Jonah Hex.
Dr. Watson.
It was a buddy movie. Basically, it was a buddy movie. I thought Jonah Hex is a great character. His character really came out. I even liked El Diablo.
Oh, you like the backups.
Yeah, and I like Barbary Ghost.
That's where I got off the horse.
I like Barbary Ghost. That was the new character they brought it for. I actually thought Barbary Ghost, which was a Chinese character, you don't see very many Chinese characters, especially Western characters.
Well, she checks two boxes. She's like female and Chinese.
Oh, and she's hot.
Congratulations. You've filled your diversity.
That's right. No, I loved... I actually read this book this morning from beginning to end, and then I reread parts of it because I liked it so much. Hmm. I thought the storytelling was dead on. I thought the dialogue was much better. Actually, the dialogue was a cut above all the other books.
Very good dialogue, especially for Hex. He's got a real voice. I hear it in my head.
Oh, yeah. He's got a great voice. And I could totally see this as a movie or a TV show.
Don't say movie. It's poison now. Yeah. It's dead for a generation after Josh Brolin and Megan Fox were done with it.
You know, and I like the fact that they touched on his origin. Like, so if you know anything about Hex, right, it's created a long time ago.
I know nothing about Hex.
He's got this very complicated origin about how he was part of an Indian tribe, and then he had a falling out with the Indian tribe, and they cut him open, and he became like a demon, and he got blah, blah, blah. They did a great job of just in media res, getting you involved in the story.
Listen to you in media res.
Yeah, well, there you go.
You're a history major. What are you using that for? That's an English major term.
Yeah, well, you know, a minor in English. The point is that this book, I have no idea if it's going to be successful or not afterwards because Westerns are Westerns and it's a tough sell.
I think
they did a fantastic job. The creators deserve enormous credit for taking a difficult character, coming off a difficult pop culture period with a terrible movie, and turning it into something that was not only entertaining, but I thought by far the best of the whatever 8, 9, 10 books that we're reviewing today.
Well, okay, so I'll give you a little background.
Do you agree?
I do agree, largely. I have some caveats.
Are we on the same page?
Yes, we are. Okay. And I have a caveat that's external to the story. It's not the story's problem, but I give it fewer stories than you, but I'll explain that in a second. The series, Jonah Hex, has been... Justin Gray and Jimmy Palmiotti have been writing Jonah Hex, apparently, for some time.
I found that out after I read this one, yeah. So I'm going to go back and get those.
And again, Twitter. I was watching Twitter this week, and I don't know if it was Jimmy or Justin. I follow both their streams, but I think it was Justin was talking to one of his fans. And I got on Twitter, you get these fragments of conversations. If you're not following both the guys, you don't see the whole thing. But I got the impression he was responding to criticism, perhaps, of why Gotham was kind of elbowed into this series.
And I liked Gotham.
I thought it worked.
Gotham was awesome.
I don't think any justification was necessary. But Justin said, when we were doing Jonah Hex, we sold 13,000 copies a month. Since moving it to Gotham, we're selling 20. Right? Now, still, I can see you kind of blanch at 20,000 copies a month as being, you know, sales of a comic book, but it's just the age.
Actually, right? 20,000 a month means it's profitable.
Yeah. They'll be keeping going maybe as long as they like or until its inevitable decay requires a reboot. So there's plenty of this voice for Hex for you to go back and read if you want to go scare up some other collections. I agree with you. I'm eager to look forward to the next month. I didn't like the backup features as much. I didn't dislike them, but I thought they didn't compare as well to the Hex stories. And my note here was that if this was all Hex, I'd give it 4 stars. But because it's as is... because it's an anthology book and there's these backup features, I gave it 3 because I like the Hex stuff. I didn't love it as much as you did, but I liked it quite a bit. But I really didn't tumble to the backup story so much.
See, I think you got to look. I admit the El Diablo backup story with the zombies and stuff was a little weak, and that was an old DC character that was brought in. I think they did the best they could with that character.
Yeah, trademark refresh. They can put him back in the vault for 10 years.
He's not very strong as a character, but you know what? The new character, Barbary Ghost. I thought she was really good.
Well, I thought she was good too, but I think it was a great story because
I thought it was. I thought it was a chop socky sort of, you know, my father's restaurant story.
Well, really it was.
That's what I wanted. I liked that. I liked the fact that they did that.
It was a good story concept. It was a good description of a story, but it wasn't a well executed story. It told me everything.
I thought it was a well executed story.
I thought that it was really expository. It was always telling me what it was doing. It had vast stretches of summarization to get me up to speed with the action. I would rather it took some time and actually let me see the stories, the parts that were summarized rather than described, because I think it's a potentially strong character. I like the old Kung Fu series with the Chinese guy in the West.
I loved it. I loved the point of view. You're right. Maybe it could have been told a little better, but you know what? It's still not a bad story. And the artwork was great.
Yeah. And it might be an artifact of, you know, originally it was probably crammed into 4 pages a month or whatever when it was originally published. So maybe that's
felt like that.
Maybe that's one of the reasons why it's always reincorporating and resummarizing, so you know what happened the month before. It doesn't work as well as a long read, so I'm willing to give it a pass, and certainly I would read the next volume of All Star Western. And I agree with you.
So Jonah Hex, you're giving it what, a 3?
I give it a 3 because it's not all Hex. If it was all Hex, I'd give it.
See, 4. I think you should give it a 4 because it's not all Hex, and then you give it a 5 if it was all Hex.
No, I wouldn't.
I'm giving it a five. I'm going five and buying it again. I thought it was a great, and they did a great job.
See,
I could never have done I could never as a creator have done the job they did in resurrecting that character.
Well, I do. I agree.
That's a hat trick.
I'm not saying that you can do it. I mean,
I think it's a hat trick what they pulled off, and I think you deserve to give them a little high. I think I'm going to argue with you that you should give them a 4-star.
Yes, but you see, because I grade on the curve instead of just throwing.
No. I'm not just throwing stuff out.
Yeah,
I'm
you throw around praise like a sailor on leave. No, I throw around praise like manhole covers.
That's not true.
So I got to stay on a 3 because I have to review the book I have here. The book I have here has got two pretty good Jonah Hex stories with excellent voice and good narrative.
Excellent Jonah Hex stories.
Yeah. But
they're good stories. They're really good stories.
Yeah, but
very
okay.
Well told.
All right, I'll tell you why.
With a great dialogue. The dialogue is better than anything else. You got to give it 4 stars.
I can't. I won't. I'll tell you why.
I think you're wrong. You're wrong.
Well, you can think all you want, but the reason why is because, and now you're going to get very angry at me. And this is
I'm already angry.
This
I'm
is actually
right
something
now.
We should bite off.
If I had a gun, I'd shoot you.
This is something we should bite off. Maybe another podcast. I agree that the Jonah Hex stories are great stories. What I don't agree is that they're great comic book stories. And the reason is
interesting.
Okay, the reason is that they're westerns. All right, and westerns inevitably come down to guys in hats growling at each other. And their hands starting towards their pistols, and it's all in there. But you know what? That kind of story is so much better told in other medium.
But so what? You can't criticize that story for that.
Because, to me, the form and the function and the story types of comic books are all as one. So this, I'm fully willing to admit that this is a problem with me and not with the story.
Yeah, you're moving your targets around. That's not fair.
But it's not, in terms of the parabola of this podcast in the past 6 episodes, covers a lot of these same things that I'm not so desperate for Western stories and I need to read a Western comic book, right?
Right.
I can watch Sergio Leone or I can watch Clint Eastwood.
Okay, so here's what I'm going to tell you. I think this comic does better than those things in terms of as the medium.
Okay, that I'd like to know.
Okay, and this is why you need to give it 4 stars.
Okay.
Gotham City, awesome.
Gotham's kind of cool. And
yeah,
so
and there's an edge in this story of supernatural and the superheroic that doesn't exist in your average Western.
That's true. I'll give you that. So for the benefit...
And even the way he looks, even the way Jonah Hex looks, it really isn't your standard Western. It's more like, okay, there's a supernatural element to this entire story.
That's true. And that would be distracting on film, and it was in the Jonah Hex film.
Yeah, and I think the story they're telling can only be told in this comic.
So for benefit of the listeners who may not know, All-Star Western is... It's an Eastern, right? It's not really a Western because it's set in the era of the Westerns. It's the 19th right. century, but it's set in Gotham City...
Which is on evidently on the East Coast.
Yeah, it's New York, right? Or near it. Yeah. So 1880s, and it does incorporate
but it's a
some
corrupt 1880s town, which is awesome.
Yeah, and it has the Court of Owls is here. Also, the religion, the Church of Crime, who shows up later in the Batwoman series is here. They run into the first Batcave and
it's
Bruce Wayne's grandfather. That's all pretty cool.
And it's got this buddy comedy, this buddy action adventure story with the guy who starts Arkham Asylum.
Yeah.
I mean, Paul, you really need to give it 4 stars. It's not
right.
fair that you don't give it 4 stars.
Talk me into 4, but I'm going to pretend that El Diablo does not exist.
El Diablo was the weakest part of the entire thing, I admit, although it wasn't terrible considering how bad he is.
No, it's not terrible.
He's a terrible character. I mean,
I just don't want
it's an awful character, but you know what? They made him into something entertaining.
I have to admit, he's a terrible character, but I kind of like him.
Yeah, I know.
You know, this scene
That's
where...
because the creators deserve credit.
Where the guy's running around like some kind of... You know, S&M mariachi with his...
Yeah, he's awful. Even the big splash page showing him off. It's like, oh my God, this guy's terrible.
He's got his whip and his red cape. And
yeah, he's got a whip. He's Zorro. He's a terrible version of Zorro. He's awful. But you know what? It was still an entertaining story. I like the zombies. I like the fact that he left and came back and he was wounded. I mean, it actually... You know what? Hats off to all the creators. Jimmy Palmiotti, you're a friend, but everybody else who was involved in this book, great job.
Terrible ending, though. For Diablo, he just
he just walks away with a wounded arm.
Yeah, it looks like he's going to go off and serve tables someplace. He looks like a restaurant.
It did kind of remind me of Wally Wood art or something too. It was interesting art.
Yeah, interesting, but not Wally Wood.
No, so who does it remind you of? It reminds you of somebody that sort of from that sort of not a lot of splash pages or you know crazy layouts.
Yeah, good expressions. I mean, I guess what
very
you're
very human.
Yeah, I'd say the art tends. It does. I understand what you
workmanlike. It's very workmanlike story, but you know what? It's not bad.
Yeah, well, it kind of tends towards a 1960s cartooning aesthetic.
That's
so
right.
It's
That's
more
right.
on the spectrum with a Wally Wood or a Steve Ditko or something, where the faces aren't intended to be the photo real look and feel that is common in comics or that comic artists try to attain.
It was a little bit of a splash of cold water after the Hex story to jump into it. But you know what? Taking on its own merits, I thought it was really good.
Yeah, it looks a little more like an EC book or something. So I can see why you might say Wally Wood. All right,
in EC style.
All right, so you talked me into 4 stars.
But boy, what a huge... I mean, my expectations were so low for an all-star Western book, and I really, really thought it was good.
Yeah. All right, so if I will agree. I've encumbered it with a lot of things that it doesn't deserve, you know, where I said, well, it's as a comic book, it's not as interesting as a film, and as a comic book, fair. It's not all Jonah Hex. So, yeah, I'll go to 4. And again, as with Aquaman, it deserves props for being such a difficult job to do.
Oh, man.
Right? To really make this difficult character interesting. And really to not, I mean, they all the Western tropes are serviced here, but they don't reproduce any of them. Considering, no. I mean, they don't do High Noon. They don't do Outlaw Josie Wales. They don't do Unforgiven. They are telling an original story.
There's not really a dull moment in the whole story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good job, guys. Really good job.
So congratulations job. To the team, and we will be there for the next issue of All-Star Western. So that's the last book we're going to review. Before I do the summary of the scores here, any overall sort of overarching comments or closing thoughts on New 50 or the few 52 that we've read here?
You know, I'm now much more inclined to be a DC fan. I have to say that the editors, after reading the Batman one, at first I was saying I'm out, right? I'm not going to ever become a DC fan.
Or at least it wasn't necessary.
Yeah, it wasn't necessary. There's no urgency. But because we've been trading these books and we started sort of building up and I've read now enough of them, I think that DC deserves a lot of credit for how they've relaunched their line, and they've done a great job. And in fact, the quality has been, you know, I would say B or B plus or better on all these different books, which is amazing.
Does it interest you enough that you go track down some of the other books that we have?
Well, now I'm going to be much more inclined to read other DC graphic novels from the New 52. Right. I don't want to necessarily go back before that. I want to start off from the New 52.
Because this current month, I think, and we record this in December of 2012. I think November of 2012 was the last of the collections of the original launch of New 52. So from this point forward, it's either second volumes of these stories or books that have been canceled and restarted.
Restarted. But I'm going to keep going to my bookstore and buying new 52 books.
Yeah, and there's some that come highly rated, or highly recommended. Certainly, I was interested in the Wonder Woman book. I'm not crazy about Grant Morrison, but his take on Superman in action is supposed to be pretty good.
I want to see Justice League now. That was the first one that was supposed to be.
Yeah, I don't know about Justice League.
I got to look at it. I really want to read it now.
Yeah, well, it's a Jim Lee book, and he's really strong, but he also draws pinups. You know, talk about a fast moving book. That's going to be a one dump, not a two dump. A lot of big panels.
It's going to be a standing up and pee book.
Yeah, a lot of big panels, gritty jaws. I agree. I mean, my own reading habits in the last year, I've been reading a lot of digital comics because I've got this Marvel digital subscription where I can read them unlimited. And I know you've tried to do that and you can't hack the interface. And I don't blame you because
I want to read it on my iPad. That's the thing. Yeah, I just don't want to do it on my iPad.
The interface, the search of that Marvel system is an abomination.
Fix it.
But so I can read it. I have basically no interest in new books, so all the old books I've been reading have been digital. So I haven't been buying Marvel omnibuses or trade paperbacks or anything. Most of the purchases I've made in the last year have been the DC books, and it's because I can't get them, you know, kind of cheap digitally, right? It's curious because if I hadn't been buying these, I probably wouldn't have been buying comic books at all. So they have gotten me as a lapsed reader, I guess.
Yeah, I'm interested in these characters now, and I was never interested in these characters before, so they did their job, at least by appealing to core comic fans.
Yeah.
Right? I think they're still pretty hard sells for people that don't like comics.
Yeah, I think so too.
For all these things, for every one of these books. There isn't one book that I would recommend necessarily to a non-comic book fan, but there's lots that I would recommend to anybody who likes comics.
Yeah.
And I think that was probably their target, and they did hit it.
I think they may be... I think maybe that was their editorial brief, but they ended up just hitting the lapsed readers. Okay, well let me summarize our recommendations here. Let me add them up real quick, just so that I can. As we add them up real quick, so from lowest to highest, the books that were least successful for us, all these books were rated fives. Now, 5 out of 10 isn't bad. 5 out of, you know, that's average. And there's nothing wrong with being average. Not everything is a really high number. But 5 out of 10. We gave 5 out of 10 to Justice League Dark, to Frankenstein, Agent of Shade, even though almost wrong, to Batwoman, which I think is a little harsh, to iVampire. Some of the books I really like are Frankenstein, Batwoman, iVampire, all books that I like, but they were pulled down by Ohm's kind of crazy grades. So 5 out of 10 for those. And of those, I recommended only sticking with Batwoman, and Chris suggested sticking with Animal Man and iVampire because he hoped his wife and daughters might read it. So weak recommendations maybe for iVampire, Batwoman. Coming in at the next tier were books that we rated a 7 between the two of us, 7 out of 10. And here we see Swamp Thing, Animal Man, Demon Knights, and Batman with recommendations from Chris that he will continue reading Animal Man, Demon Knights, and Batman, and my recommendation was I continue reading Demon Knights. So of these, it looks like Demon Knights is the best of that particular tier. Can't go far wrong with any of those books. And then the books that we give them the strongest, most unreserved reservations for, we have Supergirl. We rated 8 out of 10. Both Chris and I recommended that you pick up the next volume. Aquaman, we rated 9 out of 10. Both recommended you pick up the next volume. And then with some cajoling, All-Star Western, rated 9 out of 10, and we both recommend that you read the next volume. So there you have it, our look at the Few 52. That was fun. Maybe we'll do it again. Maybe we'll come back and look at some other volumes 6 months from now, or maybe 6 months from now we'll be looking at the Marvel Now series, which is even now rolling out as they attempt to replicate or better the success of their crosstown rivals in the slow-rolling reboot of their particular comic book line. So thanks to Mr. Ohm for joining me and contributing his thoughts. Just to wrap up, I was going to mention, you said you're interested again in reading DC books. Now, right now, Marvel's doing the same thing. They have this new initiative called Marvel Now. They're relaunching their books in kind of a rolling reboot.
I'll be following them, I think. Now, for me, it's really interesting as both on a professional basis and as a fan, to come back in and see how the creative team is handling these characters, and also, you know, are they working for me or not working for me? So I'll be getting all the Marvel Now books as well.
So maybe 6 months, a year from now, we'll sit down and do this on Marvel Now and talk about the new Uncanny Avengers and these other books.
If we haven't been running out of town on a rail by that time.
Yeah, that's right. That's true. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Ohm, for your feedback and for sitting in. I appreciate it. I appreciate it. Because this podcast has run so long, we'll go real fast. We'll finish up last few bits of business, and then we'll be done for the month. The next step here is the plug of the month. My plug of the month is for another website. It's readcomicbooks.net. Readcomicbooks.net. This is a news and forum site that's been online since July. And it's a nice site. The reason I'm recommending it specifically is because there's a new feature over there called Best of the Week, which is being edited by my friend and net buddy Aaron Myers. And Best of the Week runs fan picks of their people's favorite comic book panels of the week, just based on whatever books they've been reading recently or been reading that week. Aaron has very kindly invited me to participate. I've added panels. Of course, being stuck in 1978, I'm not looking at new books unless it's Saga. So they indulged me and let me do a classic panel. So for the last 3 weeks, I've contributed panels from the origin of Adam Warlock, classic Jack Kirby, Ben Grimm panels, other stuff. So check out readcomicbooks.net. Look at the whole site and keep an eye out for the Friday feature, Best of the Week, where I contribute a comic panel from the past. That will do it for this month. I want to thank my co-host, Mr. Chris Ohm, for joining me today and for making, for contributing so much to reading these new 52 books and bringing some interesting and occasionally wrong-headed, but...
I'm totally right. I'm also
well-prepared opinions. To our broadcast today, I want to thank Mo Christensen over at the We Talk Comics Network for engineering the show and for distributing it to all and sundry. Also thank my friends, readers, and listeners. Because my next podcast isn't until January, let me also take this opportunity to wish you a safe and happy holiday. May there be superheroes in your stocking or whatever non-denominational gift receptacle you prefer. Until next time, for Chris Ohm, this is Paul O'Connor of the Long Box Graveyard Podcast signing off. I will see you in the funny papers.